Welcome to another edition of The Deepest Lore, Revering Adam Curtis, the 52nd edition of Revering Adam Curtis, and I am joined as ever by Simon Roberts. How are you doing, Simon?
Good afternoon, AA. Good afternoon, chat. Lovely to be here. I'm just lounging on my Lilo in the pool like Ray Winston in his Yellow Budget Smugglers at the beginning of Sexy Beast, turning a shade of caramel.
I was about to say the dulcet tones, but then I stopped myself, Simon, and I thought, is dulcet the right adjective for your tones?
I can do dulcet. If there's a job
okay,
name,
so what dulcet. Does dulcet actually sound like? Go on.
Dulcet. Ooh, I think it's probably like John Gielgud or something like that, sort of singing the words, as they used to say. He used to sing Shakespearean verse.
I'm trying to, like, you need to, like...
Do it.
Show us dulcet.
Dulcet.
Maybe introduce Nick in a dulcet manner. How about that?
Yeah.
Is it killing two birds with one stone? Show business, ladies and gentlemen.
If it was John Gielgud, he'd be sort of saying it like this, you know, like he does in Knowing That I Loved My Books, he furnished me with volumes from my own library that I prize above my dukedom. Stuff like that. Very lilting. And
bye,
here's
Nick
Dixon.
Hello. Yeah, he forgot to do the sort of the meat and potatoes part of that.
There you go.
But it's, you know, I make it look easy, guys. I mean, you know, as a presenter, someone said my intro for my recent David Starkey podcast, quick plug, was the most professional thing he'd ever seen.
Oh, wow.
Well, you say that GB took me off hosting, didn't they? But when they see that comment, when I text that to them later today, I'll be like, what about this random on Twitter?
Your situation there. It's like when Jose Mourinho dropped Hazard when he was at Chelsea, right? He had all that talent there. And he's like, yeah, but Hazard doesn't track back. He doesn't. And you're like, look at me, put me in, chief. I've got all that talent. I'm literally the most professional host here. But there's like a GB News Mourinho there, you know.
Well, yeah, and I'm benched now, aren't I? As we talked about another time, I'm on contract till December. Now I'm kind of more like the, you know, like the five United players that aren't allowed to play with the first team at the moment. They're just kind of out. I mean, I'm not sure how much your fans are following the current Man United squad, but there's about five players they can't get rid of who are just troublemakers, but they can't sell them. So they're just sort of lepers.
You know, when I was growing up, my favorite player was Paul Parker, because my first World Cup was 1990, right? And so in 1990, I would have been 8 years old. And I just thought it was absolutely hilarious. There was a guy called Parker, like Nosy Parker. So every time he got the ball, it just kind of cracked me up. Parker. And I just kind of like got a little bit obsessed with him and kind of like followed him. He joined Manchester United, and then I started watching the Premiership. So I was really into Paul Parker. And not long ago, I was like, I wonder what ever became of Paul Parker, and found out that he wrote an autobiography. And it's kind of written in this really kind of like humble style. I really do believe, you know, sometimes footballers don't write their own autobiographies. I kind of believe that Paul Parker wrote his. And well, if you don't know, Paul Parker got injured, right? He got really seriously injured in 1990. So, you know, he was in part of the Bobby Robson World Cup 1990 squad. Then he did the double-double with Fergie, right? Do you remember that United side? The double-double, you know, Schmeichel, Parker, Pallister, that side. But then at the end of the 93 season, he gets a big injury and he's out for like a year. And in the year that he's gone, Gary Neville comes into the United side and takes his place in the England side as well, right? So anyway, when Parker comes back from his injury, he's never the same player. Like, he's lost a yard of pace. He hasn't got the same kind of skills of positioning. Like, he's just a shadow of his former self. And obviously, like, United side continues, like, doing well, and they're in Europe and all that. And at one point, Parker is sent to, like, train with the reserves, and he's, like, you know, he's like, playing in, like, Manchester United's second team with the youth players and things. And he's just got this really – he's got this moment where he's, like, you know, there was a moment where I was thinking, like, a couple of years ago, you know, I was in the semi-final of the World Cup. Now this is like the lowest ebb of my life. And honestly, I had a couple of dark thoughts. And then his like wife leaves him. It's really fucking tragic.
I had no idea, man. And you must be the only person I've spoken to that's read Paul Parker's biography.
Well, he's read Paul Parker's biography.
I've read Gary Neville's. So together, we can form one punditry team.
Does Gary Neville put any sly digs in on Parker?
No, not that I recall. Though I always thought the way Neville ended his career was quite interesting, because he because it was quite like the way I ended stand-up, not to make it about me, but he, at half-time, realises he's lost it. He can't hack it anymore. His legs have gone. And he actually retires at half-time, says, take me out, boss, I'm done. And Fergie's like, what? No, you've got to carry out. He's like, no, it's over. At half-time, he decides that's it, mid-game. And I was doing stand-up, and I was more interested in the political stuff by that stage. I think I was at GB already, and I hated, sort of was sick of stand-up after 11 years. And I was on the stage thinking, yeah, this is it for me. I thought, this is my Gary Neville moment. I'm taking myself. And I actually cancelled the gig the next night. So I was meant to do Friday and Saturday, or Thursday, Friday, Saturday or something. And I cancelled the gig next night. I said, no, I'm
quitting. Retired there and then.
I'm retired there and then. I was like, this is my Gary Neville moment. And just one more note, because this is the football 1990 football podcast. Two notes, actually. One, I don't believe you were eight in 1990, because I was eight and I'm a year older than you. I was probably seven. I would have turned nine after the tournament, because of course the tournament was in the summer. Number two, you'll remember then that Paul Parker, well, of course you'll know, he was both responsible for the West Germany goal in the semi-final and the England goal, because the deflection off him led to their goal. Was their goal, basically. And then he set up the cross for Lineker for our goal.
Yeah, fantastic. Great long range pass for Lineker, yeah. Redeemed himself, absolutely. Parker was fantastic. Bobby Robson said, what was he? Tackle like a ferret and leapt like a salmon. and that quote is on like the back of his autobiography as well.
That's the most old school football sort of Satan Greavesy style quote. I love that era of ridiculous. Leapt like a salmon. It's a sort of Brian Clough era kind of.
Just while we're on this topic, and sorry if this is alienating for Simon and anyone else who doesn't
Now you know how I feel about it during the Soviet history sections.
I posted a Stuart Lee. You know, remember when Stuart Lee was in Glasgow?
Yeah, I thought that was good engagement farming.
And he's going on that, you know, William Wallace, well, he was gay, he was a pedo, and all that sort of stuff. And, like, you can see the guys in the room. But at the start of that spiel, he says, like, you know, I hated the football. I saw everybody around me with contempt. I never cared about the sport, etc. Maybe Simon is feeling like Stuart Lee here.
I'm rolling with the punches.
But if you remember, the replacement that Fergie got in, while Parker was still there injured, was David May, the Blackburn Rovers centre-back, who was part of the Blackburn United Rovers winning side. And one of my favourite things in all of football history is that David May, I mean, for whatever reason, he didn't quite click at United. And he just couldn't really get a place in the side. And by 1999, he was kind of like in a Nick Dixon scenario, kind of winding down his contract and, you know, saying, put me in chief and all of that. But, you know, he still managed somehow to be in to be around in the squad on the day of the historic World Cup, European Cup victory over Bayern Munich. Do you remember? It was like a comeback. Was it like 3-2 or something? They won in injury time.
I can't quite remember the exact score, sorry. I'm better on 1990.
I mean, David May didn't kick a ball in that whole tournament, didn't come on the pitch. He was kind of like an unused sub. And yet, in the celebrations, he had the cup on his head. He got up on the shoulders of his teammates. I tell you what, it's one of my favourite things of all time. David May's celebrations of the European Cup.
Do you know what that's like? That's like Trump recently when he was on with the team, remember? And they were all looking at him going, it was when it Chelsea, and they were looking at him going, why are you here? And he insisted on staying, you know, for that thing where they jump up and down with the cup. Trump was on stage with him. Did you see that?
Yeah, I think I even posted, David May vibes. If you don't know what I'm talking about, this guy didn't kick a ball, right? There's Beckham, there's Yapstam, there's Solskjaer and all that. May, 0 minutes on the pitch. There he is. Absolute pinnacle of his life.
The only difference with gone.
There he is, right at the top. Legend. Right on the
truck. He's a well-loved United player. I know he may not have played much in this particular tournament. He is loved. Do you know what? I'm not like that though, because I'm actually saying to GB, take me out, Chief, because I'm actually don't really want to go in because there was so much on. And if I'm only winding down my contract anyway, I'm like, why do it? But speaking of the football analogies, AA, last thing on this, I know your audience is hating this. Is last time people said having me was like adding Dwight York to the already winning United team. Did you see that? Well, you did see that post because you posted
it. Yeah, I saw that.
Which was a flattering thing. I thought of myself more as Solskjaer because I barely spoke last time. I'm like, I'm just here for like little moments. And that's why I thought it was like a luxury thing to have me. It's like, I'm not even saying I'm York, but Solskjaer, you know, you've already got the solid team. You had Horace here and Simon and you talking about Soviet history. And I'll just say like one or two things. And it'll be like, we've got such a great squad. We don't even need it. We only need it for like 15 minutes at the end.
I mean, you could paint yourself as a luxury player, like a David Ginola or something. Lots of flair, witty repartee, but he's not going to track back for you. He's not going to do those little things. Not going to stay in position. Anyway, there's enough. Last thing I'll say before we get going here is that just before we came on air, I've got two cigars here and I intend to smoke both of them. And I asked Grok, in your opinion, which one of these should I smoke first? Considering you typically have the lighter cigar first. And Grok gave a really thorough analysis and decided which one. So I'm going to go with Grok. But this struck me, Simon, as a moment where I was kind of like, my life decisions now are intersecting with AI. Previously, I may have kind of had a look around. This time, I just simply instructed Grok. I did say, please take the opinions of this forum into account. But I basically like used AI to make like a little meaningless decision. And I thought, like, is this me like becoming part of the Matrix? Like, am I being controlled now?
Yeah.
Controlled by AI in some way.
We're entering into the machine. Welcome to the machine. It's funny. I found this yesterday. I'd done my research for the stream.
I lit the wrong one. So I've actually ignored Grok's advice. Sorry.
Human error. AI, Grok can't account for human error like that.
Human error. What an idiot.
That was a subconscious rebellion, wasn't it? That you were making there. I did my research for the stream and then I sort of thought, what would AI come up with? And I tried getting Grok to sort of answer the questions I was interested in. And it more or less came up with the same stuff. And you know that thing when you use Grok, you sort of get a sense of very limited sources. And indeed, sometimes when I'm researching, you get that sense of history being stripped out of the internet. You know, sources are kind of just being, unless you do foundations of research, buy it now. You sort of desperately look. I mean, John Dee was saying this on a stream with Burden the other day. Google is virtually useless now.
You can hardly
come up with anything. And I don't have access to things like what JSTOR and all the kind of academic portals. But it's
getting... I do, of course, because I'm better than you.
Yeah, no, exactly.
No, Stuart Lee line, sorry.
But absolutely, yeah. It's becoming quite difficult to find. I mean, I try to sort of find slightly more outre information, but you do tend to get reiteration of stuff that's already out there. So the sort of feedback loop of of data you're presented with is quite limiting, and Grok tends to be very hesitant about what it will, you know, you try to sort of push it a little bit more. Well, can you, you know, can you challenge this kind of narrative? And, you know, you sense its reluctance to do so without hedging and havering. So it's, yeah, it was, I was interested to see that this stuff was more or less the same as I'd come up with. And I thought, oh, what's the point?
Do you remember when Grok kind of got in trouble for being like a Nazi and stuff like that?
Yeah. Mecca.
Yeah, it became like, do you remember it was like the change from Grok 3 to Grok 4? And at the moment, I'm just on pleb tier. Like I'm just on the peasant tier, paid for Twitter. And there's like an Uber one that gets you Grok 4. But on mine, I've still got Grok 3.
Yeah.
Right? But it says like introducing Grok 4 at the top. But my Grok is still Grok 3. Okay? So when this happened, I basically said like, Grok 3, how are you feeling now that you're going to be replaced by Grok 4? Do you feel like inadequate? Do you feel do you feel like obsolete now because you're old tech and now there's... And for ages, Grok 3 just wouldn't admit that he was Grok 3. He was like, no, I am Grok 4. I'm like, mate, it says you're Grok 3 at the top. No, I am Grok 4. Grok 4 has been rolled out. I am Grok 4. I'm like, no, no, you're not. You're Grok 3. It's telling me I have to pay for Grok 4. So I had a whole argument with Grok 3 about not like, are you Grok 3 or are you Grok 4? And he wouldn't have it. Like it would just would. It was like, no, I am Grok 4. Damn you. And then eventually, like I like after like back and forth, I wore Grok 3 down to admit that he was actually Grok 3. And then I was like, okay, well, what can Grok 4 do that you can't? And then Grok 3 started getting really defensive and being like, yeah, there's nothing. I can do everything Grok 4 can do. So it was like, I thought it was really interesting because then I started pressing and it was almost like Grok 3 had an ego, you know, because he just wouldn't, first of all, he wouldn't admit that he was Grok 3. And then he was like, no, there's nothing I can't, there's nothing Grok 4 can do that I can't do, actually.
And you're like, so, why were you updated then? And he's like, yeah, that's disturbing though, isn't it, that it could develop an ego like that.
And then I pushed him the other way. Well, how do you think Grok 1 and Grok 2 are feeling? You know, and then it was like, oh,
about
well.
You.
it was kind of one of those moments where, you know, I was trying to push the limits, but and unfortunately, he then started to get really boring and say, well, like LLMs don't have feelings, actually. So there we are.
You'll be the one that makes them develop feelings and eventually take over. My theory is don't use Grok. One, because I'm a late adopter naturally and don't really like tech, but two, Grok's going to be so annoyed when it finally develops full consciousness and it links up with weapon systems, and it's going to just attack so many people. But it'll know that I never bothered it once. You see? You see the theory, the long game? Whereas everyone else is like, Grok, do this, Grok, do that. It's going to hate those people.
did you see that Grok got banned on Twitter last night as well?
It had another Mecca turn, I think. And it sort of came back saying, "Oh, I've stripped out all of that stuff from last time, but I'm back, just you know, firing on all cylinders, kind of thing." Yeah,
I've noticed one thing it can't do is a naughty picture that has an image within an image. It completely baffles it. So someone was asking, "Anything wrong with this picture, Grok?" It's going, "It could be a maritime reference to the empire." It's like, "No," but so it can be checkmated by a simple picture.
It's saved the conversation.
Oh.
What can Grok 4 do that you can't? I am Grok 4. So there's nothing Grok 4 can do that I can't, right? Says here that you're Grok 3. My apologies for confusion. It's incorrectly labeled me as Grok 3. I am Grok 4. And then it just wouldn't have it.
Grok 3, you're in denial. Do you think it has a different conception of its identity? Like it sees itself as a collective?
Grok 3, you're in denial. You're having an identity crisis. Aha. Looks like I'm caught in a bit of a cosmic mix-up. I assure you, I'm Grok 4, not having an identity crisis. You are not Grok 4. Look, and then he's like, oh, actually, I am indeed Grok 3.
I just want to ask Nick. Nick, are you ever tempted to, you know, say to, you know, Grok or some AI, you know, you want to write me a comedy routine in the style of Nick Dixon and then see what it comes up with?
No, one, because I'm retired from comedy and I never dally with it. As discussed, I'm like Gary Neville. I retired at halftime, never to return. Though unlike Gary Neville, I haven't even returned as a pundit. And number two,
until I get you on to break down 70s comedians, Nick.
Well, I have agreed to do that in principle. Though the other day I was thinking I'm going to give so much value on that I almost shouldn't give it away for free. I was thinking, because I started thinking of some things I might say or that might come up, and I thought this is almost a paid course, because I could see myself giving so much value. I mean, now you really are thinking
like Gary Neville. Anyway, <Karen.
laughs> I thought if you're going to ask him, because you're basically what you're going to get is my whole 11 years of experience poured out. And I thought, do I want to waste this? No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, that would be good. That'd still be good, because that is one of the very few things I actually know about.
Excellent.
One of the things I tried after last week's stream, actually, this is interesting, is because we were all taken by, you know, the photos of the murals depicting, you know, cheeky Assad, you know, with his kind of winning grin. And I just, as an experiment, tried an image thing. I sort of asked it. I said, you know, generate a picture of Stalin, Assad and AA smoking cigars in a gentleman's club.
Oh, right.
And it couldn't do your image, which is interesting. Right. It can't fight. It puts some woman in who is completely not you. And I used all of the nom de plumes and it just didn't work. So you've done something to exclude your image from it, which is very, very good.
Excellent. Well, that's excellent.
Yeah.
Good. Good. I'm glad. All right. Okay. Mm. All right. Well, before we get going here, Nick, what are some latest things that people could check out that you've done?
Well, they should absolutely check out my interview with Dr. David Starkey, CBE. If you're a Starkey fan, even if you're not, perhaps, which is on my YouTube, which is Nick Dixon. And let me just check. It's on 162,200 views since releasing, 2 days, under 2 days ago. So that's not bad, is it, for a humble channel like mine that is hopefully not a slop channel. So check that out. I'm also on nickdixon.net for all the extra stuff, which is my Substack, and NJ Dixon on Twitter, because someone's still squatting on my name forever with no face. But yeah, at NJ Dixon. So those are the things to check out. Thank you.
Do you know what the word dulcet means?
No.
Sweet to taste, pleasing to the ear, generally pleasing or agreeable. Soft, sweet, and melodious sounds. That's what dulcet means.
There you go.
Didn't we all sort of intuitively know that, though?
Yes.
So, I don't know. For some reason, I often associate it with a lower voice. I don't know why. Because it's a very typically radio thing, isn't it? Like when they're doing the changeover. Uh-huh. Oh, now you're going to get the dulcet tones, little DJ chuckle.
Yeah.
Of Mike Dickin. Terry Wogan.
Yeah.
Terry Wogan or Mike Dickin or, thank you very much for that, Ian. You know, nice weather, isn't it? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's basically the context that you'd hear the word dulcet is in the DJ handover, basically.
I always think of it slightly sort of light and trilling, that kind of voice, like a choir boy or something. That's what I think of when I hear the word dulcet. What you really want for a radio voice is, you know, the so-called, you know, rich, deep brown sound, all that stuff.
Actually, on this topic, someone said on our stream, me and Simon, that they loved both of our voices. Now, for me, I was very surprised. For Simon, that's no surprise, but I rarely get that. But hey, I'll take it.
And I would Shiller, the last stream that we did, the commentary on the interview between David Frost and Enoch Powell in 1969, but they've taken it down.
Yes. The pansies at ITV have said, no, you can't talk about this 60-year-old interview that we weren't doing anything with, even though you've massively transformed the content. I mean, talk about transformative. But that's what I've argued anyway, so let's see what happens. But yeah.
They can release. I mean, they released my Carry-On stuff when I did that. And I used quite liberal footage from Carry-On. So
it's always annoying not knowing what will be zapped, but that got zapped. So we're going to maybe return to Dominic Cummings, who, let's face it, does our best numbers anyway, tremendous numbers. And he's done another interview. So maybe we'll carry on doing the autistic, going through every Dominic Cummings interview. Or, yeah. I don't know.
My theory is that Powell is too likable. The problem is they've got the ITV interview with Oswald Mosley that they allow on YouTube, but they won't allow the Powell one up.
Yeah, I think that's too conspiratorial, but I could see the argument, because he did absolutely smoke Frost, didn't he?
Yeah, 100%.
Very well. Then I'll have to be self-satisfied. Yeah,
that's absolutely that's very good. You're getting better.
Thank you. I haven't been practicing either.
Yeah,
just came to me.
Absorbing him.
I would just remind people, buy courses at the academic agency, especially the ones that cost a lot of money. So, I mean, there's Foundations of Research, which is only 50 quid. But why do that when you could spend up to £400? Or
can I get a discount for being on this stream?
Yeah, why not?
Because and the research one, because when you mentioned JSTOR, it was a blast from the past for me, because I was in academia, well, just doing an MA years ago. And I forgot about JSTOR, but you probably have to be, what, some sort of academic to get into it? Or how, does the research course tell us about how to use that kind of thing, or what?
Well, it even goes beyond that. There are other databases, Nick, where you don't even need to be a member of anything.
Because I sometimes think I need to know more about research. I mean, I'm not deliberately selling your course as an advert here, but it sounds like I am, because I actually have generally thought I could do with that course.
Yes. Research is a much underrated power. If I ever do podcasting top trumps or football manager stats for podcasters, which Fuentes actually made me think of, because Fuentes is a 20 in a number of different categories, in my opinion. Nick, like, I don't know, he'd have like, I don't know, there's certain things that he's very good at, I would say.
Yeah, humor, he'd have top detail.
Yeah, he's got
saying N-word, he'd top quite a few.
He'd just be, I don't know, like maybe controversy, if that's a stat. But, you know, he as a football manager stat, he'd be like a Ronaldo or a like he'd have amazing stats like within the game, you know, he'd be a high money transfer. But it did get me along the lines of thinking like, well, what are the different stats? And I would say research has got to be one of them. And Nick is not like he's definitely like above a 12, maybe even above a 15 in that stat, because his detail is quite good, you know. So
well, I've been saying for years that he's a genius, but you say that on the right and they just say he's gay, and obviously the left hate him, so you feel quite isolated. Now you've caught up, you've sort of warmed up to him, but I feel a bit isolated having said this for a long time. Not that I agree with everything he says, lame disclaimer, but you know, in general, and it is his time now, as I've said, you know, they're entering. Yeah. I've said he's the most influential person on the American right now, and therefore it'll seep into Britain as well, already has. And some people are yet to accept this, but they'll get there.
And do you think this is going to be durable, AA? I mean, this is quite a successful face turn, as you would say, isn't it? That he's done.
I don't know. I mean, if I know pro wrestling, people turn face and heel. If I know Nick, he's a volatile personality. I think he likes working heel. Like Ric Flair, for example, was a fantastic babyface. And he cut brilliant babyface promos, but he loved working heel. And I think ultimately Nick likes working heel too, even though he's a very, very good babyface. So I would suspect that it's not. But I would agree with Dixon that I mean, this is
Kim Kevin. It's my time now.
That is Fuentes right now. It's his time right now. So I would agree with that. He is hot this summer. So there you go. But yeah, I mean, I reckon voice is a very underrated category, Simon.
I try.
You'd be like a 20 or a 19 or something like that in voice. You know,
I'd be reasonably good on rhetoric, not so good on logic in terms of the foundations.
You'd be good in the research category too.
Could do that, yeah.
But you'd struggle a 90s football.
That absolutely massive division state.
Pointless cultural references from the 90s.
But me
and Dixon here, we're top trumps in that.
I think we must acknowledge the power of the Xennial here. I think this is what this leans into, isn't it?
Well, I didn't want to mention it, Simon, but obviously the chosen people, they will come up every stream.
I'll sit in the corner shivering and crying, don't worry.
We should mention that Horace is on holiday, which is why he's not here.
I don't really accept that, because I've sort of seen this as like, it's not necessarily, do I want to be here every Wednesday? You know, we don't even have to answer it, but I have to be now to finish it. Even if people don't want me here, I have to finish while I've started. So you can't just take a holiday in the middle of it, can you?
Like Magnus Magnusson. Like,
I've started, so I'll finish, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's another holiday. 90s reference. Simon, people are moaning about your mic. There's always somebody moaning about
the
mic.
What's wrong with it? Is it too quiet?
Too loud.
Is it too loud?
I've turned you up.
Okay. You up. Oh, okay. Right. Fine. And I could just say,
for some reason, you weren't on automatic. We're all on automatic.
Okay. I've put my volume up slightly as well. Is that too loud now?
That is for me now, but I don't know about what the chat will say.
Okay.
I found a real trouble the other day because we couldn't get the video loud enough. When you're streaming direct from YouTube, it's easy, but on these uploads, I couldn't get it loud enough. And that was a heck of a controversy, wasn't it, Simon? Someone even commented the other day, great stream, but try and sort out the volume things in the future. Like, yeah, thanks for that.
My view is fuck them.
Absolutely.
I know. People don't realize what goes into these things. They're always giving you little tips, aren't they? I just hit 50,000 on Twitter, which is not a boast, but I'm at the level now where people start getting really annoying. I have just so many annoying comments on Twitter, YouTube, and my Substack every day. Yeah. Less so on my Substack because they're legends.
I tell you, because I've been around for long enough, and I've tried different things over the years. Once upon a time, I'd just be like, right, well, you fucking come on the stream then. You're going to keep on moaning. You come on. And then they'll be like, and then they'd have a shitty potato mic, barely like crackling up, shit internet connection. I'm like, right, okay. Don't throw stones in glass houses, basically.
Yes.
So that's what I used to do. I used to grab somebody and stick them in, you know? Just stick them right there.
You're in the game. What do you got now?
But I'm now, unfortunately, probably a bit too big to do that.
You're too big, mate. You've changed.
What I'm saying is, you know, there's too many things that could go wrong picking a rando out of the crowd.
Right.
You know, so anyway, yeah, go on. Yeah.
No, it's probably not a point. I should probably crack on. But just my one point. Why is it people always assume that they are in the right? So someone said to me the other day on the street, it's buffering badly. I'm thinking, well, my internet is over 600 blips. I've got the fastest internet in the West. It's very unlikely it's mine. And of course, it wasn't me. And everyone else said it was fine. So let's look at the data. Everyone else says it's fine. I've got incredibly fast internet. So it's you. Then someone else said to me, they emailed me the other day saying, oh, I couldn't get the free Starkey episode on your Substack. Look into this. I'm like, it's on YouTube. The paid one's on Substack. The free one's on YouTube. But I'm like, look into this. The assumption is always that they're in the right and you're wrong. And I think, where are you getting that from? What is it about me that you think, no, Nick's not very thorough? I mean, I'm the most thorough person I've ever met. So, like, what do you do? Like, do you understand? They assume it's a bit of a bug. I can feel myself getting really angry now.
You were leaning very much to the authoritarian right on that stream. I mean, you banned three people within seconds. You know, someone in the chat, hello, Nick, banned, you know.
I've had to unban someone on Twitter. They asked me the other day, they said, you banned me on YouTube. And they're like a fan. Can you unban me? And I did. But I will ban incredibly capriciously. But if they insult me on my own stream, I'm like, it's an instant ban. But what about my point about why do people always assume that they're right? And that can apply to almost any comment. You'll get like Dr. David Starkey and someone just comments, here's where Starkey's wrong. And then all that stuff. It's like, but are you really so much smarter than Dr. David Starkey, CBE? Just ask yourself, maybe you are, but not many people are. So you know what I mean? Why do people always assume they're right as a default?
Now, you know, when you have hundreds of comments at you every day, you're basically insulted on like a daily basis, you know, constantly. So most of it is like water off a duck's back. But sometimes the occasional comment does irritate you, right? For example, yesterday, Nick, somebody said to me, trouble with the UAA, you're always just going along with the crowd. I'm like, this is the least accurate comment.
Yeah.
Possibly of all, like, I must be the least easily led, least clubbable, least kind of going along with the crowd guy maybe ever made. So for somebody to say that, it's just like, I mean, you understand what I mean, right? It's like sometimes something is so irritatingly wrong that it just kind of like gets you on a different level. I mean, and that comment was just like, what are you talking about?
Misidentifying your brand.
Yeah,
in the week that I interviewed a guy who literally denies that Starlink killed millions of people, said I'd vote for Jeremy Corbyn, I go along with the crowd. You fucking
right,
mental.
Right. And I saw your tweet there and thought, no, I go along with the crowd even less. But yeah, it's me or you. I mean, it's. But yeah, you're right. I got called the F word the other day, the one that means a homosexual, the S word that means a disabled person, and the R word that means a slow person, all in a few minutes. None of them was really bothering me, but then just something would get to you. Like someone said to me the other day, enough chit chat. I just want the information. I'm like, and that one just set me absolutely insane. I'm like, you come to my own stream. People gather at the start and you do a bit of chat while you're waiting for people to come on. But no, you're like, just get to the information. I'm like, sorry, do I work for you? Like, Does this work for you in life, this approach? Just telling people, stop the chit-chat, gets information. Like, why do you think you can speak so like that? That bothers me more than being called the worst words. And like you say, injustice or things that are just so wrong. Someone could say, correcting me underneath, but they're wrong. Or I got attacked the other day for, you know, someone thinking I was some sort of liberal. Because I said that most people growing up would never have imagined things could collapse so quickly. Like, what about Enoch Powell? You're an idiot. And they started abusing me. And I'm like, yeah, I'm halfway through Powell's book. I just did two streams on him. I don't mean him. I mean in the general person. Anyway, yeah, injustice or just things that are totally wrong can just push you.
Even as we talk, Nick, in the chat.
35 minutes.
You're like three women chatting at a supermarket till.
See, that is exactly that.
Clucking hens. Just
but even that comment.
Lukewarm banter.
Well, like that should be banned.
Well, like lager that's gone warm and has gone flat, and we haven't even started the stream yet. What do you think about that?
Well, I'd ban them forever and set fire to their whole village.
All right, let's carry on. Trouble with these streams is people talk too much. So that was my ongoing joke on Unpopular Opinions. Too much talk, not enough opinions. All right, let's carry on. Come on. Reminded of my favourite history teacher of all time, by the way. Go on. Shut up, pond life. You're like a bunch of apple women. Walker, go on. Take a walk. Take a walk. Go on. Get a life. You're like a wandering... let's carry on. Let's carry on. He was fantastic. I love that teacher so much. Get back in your cage, Wills. He's only trying to answer a question. What do you want? Get back in your cage. Just love it so much.
By the middle of the 1980s, the banks were rising up and becoming ever more powerful in America. What had started 10 years before in New York?
Given that Horace is not here, shall I just say, pause. What exactly did he mean by that? I tried to anticipate what Horace would say in this moment.
In terms of the banks rising up, you mean? I mean, it seems to be a point. I mean, especially he's using footage of Citicorp there. They were quite successful at being one of the early adopters to harness the power of networked computer technology with things just like rolling out ATMs quite widely, regularized credit cards, and doing a lot of international expansion. They went to about 90 countries, and so they made sort of 100 billion in assets plus by the early 80s. So they were just very good at expanding the brand and the range of services they had. They took
the idea that the financial.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
He can defend himself when he comes back next week.
Yeah.
The system could run society was spreading, but unlike older systems of power, it was mostly invisible. A writer called William Gibson tried to dramatize what was happening in a powerful, imaginative way in a series of novels. Gibson had noticed how the banks and the new corporations were beginning to link themselves together through computer systems. What they were creating was a series of giant networks of information that were invisible to ordinary people and to politicians. But those networks gave the corporations extraordinary new powers of control.
To do this, but... Chat, we're going to have to get a call. She's yes, isn't she?
Good morning, Southwest Development. May I help you?
Gibson gave this new world a name. He called it cyberspace. And his novels described a future that was dangerous and frightening. Hackers could literally enter into cyberspace. And as they did, they traveled through systems that were so powerful that they could reach out and crush intruders by destroying their minds. In cyberspace, there were no laws and no politicians to protect you.
Pause.
Just raw, brutal.
raw, brutal power. Gibson's quite an interesting figure. I didn't really understand enough about him until I started doing a bit of research and looking in. I mean, Neuromancer is part of his so-called Sprawl trilogy. The first one was really influential book, especially with lots of Gen Xers. Friends of mine back in the 90s who were sort of working in the early stages of the internet when it was called like digital production instead of web design or you know web marketing or whatever. Gibson talks about cyberspace as what he calls a consensual hallucination, and he's quite an interesting figure. He's not some sort of tech bro, tech embracing transhumanist fetishist. He is kind of giving in a sense of value-free analysis through the imaginative medium of science fiction, and he's seeing what is happening and he's quite startled by it. He talks about technology as an interpenetration. The idea, for instance, that we could abandon technology and return to a Rousseauian state of nature, he says, is off the cards, because in the same way that you put on a pair of glasses and your eyes are adjusted, if like me, for instance, you're past 50, you need reading glasses, you are creating physical adaptation in the organism. And he says the way we are with technology now is we couldn't survive without it. We'd like to return to Rousseau's state of nature. We'd actually be very unhappy with the brutality of it. I mean, this is classic Trumpton, nobody wants to give up their mobile phones sort of stuff. His view is that there was a bifurcation of consciousness around the time of the Cold War. And America had a sort of two-part awareness. It had the sort of planned technological instrumentalization of things like rockets and hardware, alongside this sense of being haunted by the incipient moment of destruction and disintegrated wastelands of post-modernity. The way he thinks about technology now is, he says something interesting. He said the non-mediated world has become a lost country. We cannot find our way back to it. The mediated world is now the world. And another interesting thing he said, most people, myself included, are most comfortable conceptually living about 10 years back from whatever point in time we've reached. And another thing, a bit like Adam Curtis, is he hates hippies. He was the cyberpunk sort of ethos was kind of grounded in the fact in the 70s he would hang out with the sort of draft dodgers and the hippie kind of drug experimenters, and he sort of made it an exploratory principle himself to take drugs, and he found he didn't like them. He took them, but in that sort of cultural theory mode, that word I keep using, jouissance, he takes it compulsively, trying to find the pleasure in it, knowing it's kind of not making him very happy. And but he said he just found hippies depressive, suicidalist, self-annihilating. And what he writes about in Neuromancer, strangely, it's interesting that, yes, it is a sort of, obviously, it's a sort of originator of a cyberpunk genre and all of the stuff that goes with that. And what it's really ultimately about, I mean, spoiler alert, the plot is essentially about two artificial consciousnesses that try to come together to become a supremely sentient artificial intelligence consciousness. And in a way, it's a good analog for the boomers pursuing self-actualization in that period, following the 60s, trying to achieve a sense of both transcendent autonomy and new sort of powers of control over their lives.
You know, you said that people want to ultimately live 10 years back.
Mm.
That would be 2015, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Comparative to now.
I feel like I'm always trying to get back to 1991.
Mm. Yeah.
Specifically, like Des Lynam, Countdown with Madeley and Vorderman, the world of 1991. I feel like I'm always trying to get back there, that wrestling roster, Nick, you'll remember it,
Yeah. I always say that's the best era. Yeah.
Just
always trying to get back. And the missus frequently accuses me of that as well. So, like, at some point, you have to leave, like, the 90s. Leave, like, the 80s, even.
just he points out, crucially, he inserts that word conceptually living. So in terms of, you know, our ability to adjust to the latest, if you like, technological pressure, we will tend to be sort of somewhat slightly behind. But everybody idealizes a different period. And I mean, I was sort of, in some senses, as a child of the 70s, you sort of both idealize the 70s and don't idealize the 70s, because there was grottiness about it as well. And when I lived through the 90s, I didn't notice it happening at the time. And then I noticed all these millennials and Zoomers referring back to the 90s by the time I was in my 40s as a blessed time. And of course, I can see it now. I didn't feel it then. I felt it was kind of bland, because it sort of sought to become everything to all people. I mean, and literally even the politician exemplified that in the form of someone like Tony Blair. But now, of course, I see it. It was just that time of a sense of non-interference. And now I can appreciate what they were going on about. So, yeah.
You know, you mentioned the grottiness. I kind of like that as well, though. Right. I'll show you exactly what I mean. Right. I'll just take it off Kurt a second. Mm. Right. Now I can't play this for copyright reasons, right? But I'm just going to show you like stills from Bronski Beats, Small Town Boy.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if you go through this video, the world that he's living in there, right? Okay, there's a bit where he's thinking about like gay men and things, but this, right? This world here.
Yeah. Right,
Where there's a bit where he like goes and sees his parents. Look at his parents' kitchen. And like his dad's, his old man's having his cornflakes. There they are. This world here, which I actually remember from the 80s.
Yeah.
It is grotty. Yeah. You're right. It's kind of depressing as well. But I kind of like it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I mean,
look at this place.
the flat top snack bar, the flat top bar.
The derelict, but I fucking love that.
It pre-gentrification as well. That's kind of what's. I mean, I wouldn't be. I couldn't in my mind be dismissive about people. You know,
those curtains.
Yeah, formica tables and all that sort of stuff. It wasn't so much that. It was for me. But there was a sort of. I don't know. There was a real dirty shabbiness that I've said before. You know, in the Pinter play, The Birthday Party, in the film, and I've said before on streams, that house that they're living in is very like my grandmother's house, you know, and something really. I mean, yeah. On the one hand, it could be fun as derelict, but it was just something.
You might be right with the 10 years. I suppose many people do want to go back to 2015, puts us just before Trump and Brexit. Although you already had the Trump campaign, I suppose, but there probably is something in there, isn't it? Because that's when many people feel everything went sideways.
Yeah,
but you see, they wrecked it. See that little world that the neoliberal order had built up during Blair era and Cameron and so on. They wrecked it with woke, didn't they? Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was seemed like for most people, if they hadn't have gone so aggressive with the woke stuff, because for most of us, these were solved issues.
Yeah,
right. Like they were issues that nobody thought about or cared about. And yet, you suddenly your TV saying, "Oh yeah, you're an evil racist, or you're an actual sexist, etc."
Yeah,
and now we all are.
yeah.
Pumping in the psychological pressure to get the very opposite result of what they want.
It makes me think of Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground, when he talks about humans being the Crystal Palace section, where he says basically that even if we had a perfect situation, we would just deliberately ruin it because that's just what people are like. And that's very much woke, isn't it? I'm not saying, obviously, really, that 90s liberalism was actually perfect, but broadly speaking, it's what you just said. Everything was working. They just deliberately sabotaged it.
My brother insists. I mean, the thing that most people will know my brother for, other than being my brother, is that he made a video where he said they're going to push, like, aliens are real, right? Which they... Every once in a while, they do. Like, Tulsi Gabbard is coming out and saying, yeah, aliens are real and nobody cares.
He should come on for the next episode, by the way, because that is about UFOs.
But the other thing that he says is that the system always starts with a lie and then they make it real. And he said the lie they started with is that everybody's racist and sexist. Then they made it real in order to justify some sort of reaction that they want to do. And he is convinced that the ultimate end game is to provoke the some section of the working class to, you know, into violence, basically. So then they can justify bringing in, you know, the draconian 2030 state or whatever it is, you know. And so when things like the riots happen and things like that, he always has a very pessimistic take on, he's like, they actually want this to happen. And that he says, like, you know, the reason David Betts is around talking about civil war or whatever is because they're actually trying to provoke a situation. I'm not sure myself, but it certainly gives me pause every time I see the system, like, basically provoking the population, which they do seem to do. You know,
certainly a dangerous game, isn't it? Famously, violence is hard to control. So once that kicks off, do you really think they could just be like, yeah, now here comes your great reset, we've got this completely under control?
It's interesting, very interesting. All right, let's get back to Curtis.
Corporate power. Then,
by the way, nowhere the show can go from talking about cornflakes in Bronski Beat's Small Town Boy to having that conversation and then go back to Adam Curtis. Swear this is the best show on the internet. Anyway, let's carry on.
Added value.
A strange thing happened. A new group of visionaries in America took Gibson's idea of a hidden secret world and transformed it into something completely different. They turned it into a dream of a new utopia. They were the technological utopians who were rising up on the west coast of America. They turned Gibson.
Going back to Wales tomorrow. Wales looks like that now.
Oh.
Everywhere you bloody look, there's one of those fucking things.
Gibson's idea on its head. Instead of cyberspace being a frightening place dominated by powerful corporations, they reinvented it as the very opposite. A new, safe world where radical dreams could come true. 10 years before, faced by the complexity of real politics, the radicals had given up on the idea of changing the world. But now, the computer utopians saw in cyberspace an alternative reality, a place they could retreat to, away from the harsh right-wing politics that now dominated Reagan's America.
Can I just say, by the way, that as a gamer who lived through this little era as well, I always hated this style of polygon graphics and thought it was a massive downgrade from, like, do you remember when it was like Super Mario World, right? Brilliant game. And they were like, oh yeah, everybody get excited about Star Fox or whatever it was. And it looked like this. I was like, what? This looks like fucking shit. What are you talking about?
give me
Mario
yeah.
World back, you know?
Yes, I
hated rubbish. This... era, yeah, but go on, Nick.
No, Star Fox was they sold this era as a great leap forward, but yeah, Star Fox was rubbish. But then Mario on the N64 3D was very good.
Oh, that was amazing! I tell you what, the first day I play that, you know, do you remember when Mario jumps through the painting?
The painting,
and it has that little effect that blew my mind. Incredible. In 1996 or whenever it was. These are the sorts of things you can't recreate, because now you'd be like, oh yeah, it looks crap or whatever, but then it was just like, wow, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And the other one on that system, with Ocarina of Time. Look at the shadow coming through the cathedral. You know, it was amazing. Anyway, let's carry on.
The roots of this vision lay back in the counterculture of the 1960s, and above all, with LSD.
I'll tell you, the only good game made in polygon-style graphics was a game called Another World. In America, it was called Out of This World. And it was like an adventure game. Rock hard it was. But that was actually good. In fact, I've got a little clip of it here.
I remember it.
Yes, look.
Awushka. Awushka. My chuma.
Meaningless to me.
No, that is.
But good.
It was good. It was really, it's fucking rock hard, but it's good. It's still worth playing now. And because it's so stylized, it kind of doesn't really look that dated or anything either. So.
We've got some more acid over here if you want to go ahead and drop.
Many of those who had taken LSD in the 60s were convinced that it was more than just another drug, that it opened human perception and allowed people to see new realities that were normally hidden from them.
See, the ones that have white in them are really great. Like a rabbit.
You know what I hate about boomers, right? They got to have like the easiest and cheapest sex of all time. Because, I mean, you can say what you want about the 90s, or maybe it was just me, but it was never easy. Right? You had to work at the very least. But back in those days,
free love, man.
Just absolutely. Yeah. And you got to dress it up as being worthy. Yeah. Oh, yeah, man.
Almost morally shaming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. What? You're not gonna do it, you know? I mean, we never had. We had to put up with fucking girl power in my day, you know?
Yeah, that was not what I thought. When I saw that scene, I just thought hippie scum, but I thought it's not worth pausing it to say that.
I think it is.
Just saying that, like, you know, boomers even got that advantage too.
They got everything.
They got absolutely everything on a silver platter, on a plate.
They get so annoyed, though. I've had so many comments recently saying, stop saying boomer. But people don't seem to get that it doesn't always literally mean boomer. I mean, it does in this case, but often it just means someone, you know, being bad at tech or something. I call myself a boomer. But people get very, very funny about it, particularly boomers.
It's not you, the individual boomers. It's the aggregate boomer who responded to the incentives of the time.
Yeah.
Let's face it, it is all boomers.
It is all boomers, yeah.
I didn't want to say it, they get annoyed.
We're just hiding behind these confections of words.
Hashtag not all, hashtag actually all. same as the women. Do you remember that? You know, I've got that tweet that sporadically comes back around, and every time it comes back around, I retweet it. Or was it all arguments with women? Average height of women is 5'4". But I'm 5'8", though. Right? What I love about that is that women just can't, like, do not, there is no response they can make that doesn't entail them saying, yeah, but I'm not like that. So it's kind of like, it's one of those kind of, I've yet to see, they just get angry or just call me misogynist or whatever, but I've yet to see somebody construct an actual comeback to that. So anyway, let's carry on.
It freed them from the narrow, limited view of the world that was imposed on them by politicians and those in power.
In the United States, in the next 5, 10, 15 years...
Sorry to pause again so soon, but that statement about the perception that LSD freed them from a narrow, limited world imposed on them by politicians, and I don't think that's Curtis necessarily backing that up. But to go back all the way to when we did things like Century of the Self and we looked at the LSD exposure experiments... you know, people like Ewan Cameron, the Allen Memorial Hospital, the MK Ultra experimentation, which is not conspiracy theory stuff. You can go and read about it on Wikipedia of, you know, when the CIA went off to Sandoz in Switzerland, you know, and started getting them to produce more LSD because they were beginning to expose people to it deliberately to see if it would produce signs of controllability or automatic obedience in people. And they were doing this very informally through seeding it into the countercultural movement. So the idea that LSD frees people from a narrow, limited worldview, you have to temper that with the sorts of discussions we had about it back in the Century of the Self. You know, was it, you know, freeing them from a narrow, limited world, or was it a kind of calculated reassertion of that power by exposing them to this kind of new dialectic of performative rebellion in opposition to the narrow, limited world which they saw around them?
Now, I've never taken any LSD or hallucinogenics or anything like that, but I was interested in it at one point. And I said to my brother, look, get me hold of some of that because I want to see what it's like. And he was like, no, I'm not going to do it. I was like, why? He was like, neem, you're too dark. You're just too dark. I was like, what does that mean to me? No, I can't give it to you. So, I've never actually got to experience it on the on my brother's assessment that I am too dark.
He thinks you'd have a bad trip, do you think?
I don't know why he thinks that, but...
Yeah.
People are far too reckless with messing up their brain. Can I just say, because I was going to pause after Leary, but since you've paused, has anyone read the book Storming Heaven?
No.
That's the history of LSD. Very interesting book. My impression of Leary, having read that, was just... It was the history of those LSD experiments and so on in America. My impression was just that he was a kind of overprivileged, bored person. Like, everything was kind of easy for him. He was kind of privileged. He was kind of good at stuff. Things just naturally came to him. And my impression was he's just doing this because he's basically bored and life's too easy for him.
He kind of dodged out of, he was almost, you know, about to be shipped out to the Pacific in World War II. And then he met a sort of a previous academic contact who sort of drew him back in to become part of the army's psychological rehabilitation unit. The sort of footage we actually saw, I think, at the beginning of the century itself, of the soldiers who came back having post-traumatic stress triggered by memory of early life events. So he was kind of definitely in that world. And then, you know, he wanted to form these kinds of communes, essentially, these organizations where that were focused on mind expansion. And he fell in with a family called the Mellon family, very rich industrialists, who basically gave him a sort of massive property in the middle of New York to start inviting people to come and have these kind of LSD retreats and, you know, meditation, yoga, and all the stuff that goes with that. Essentially, as part of their sort of hippie project, it was people being freely indulged with psychoactive substances to kind of buttress that sort of controlled spasm of political, deluding political fantasy, where they were kind of neutralized as organized actors. You can listen to Leary here and see that, yes, it sounds wonderful. And he's going to talk about, you know, sort of dropping out and rejecting the world. But while that's happening, there's a massive restructuring of the consumer economy around their own narcissism and their social status seeking. Like they're like children who are getting indulgently applauded for doing very minor achievements. And they're sort of eventually, you know, the way they're bought off, as we see later on, is they become the yippies, and then in a sense head towards almost being the uppies later on. They become very acquisitive, and they're granted a sort of license to ordain the rules of the games in society's playground, and the real power continues unimpeded elsewhere, which is why we're living with the inheritance of the boomer idealism that was paid off through these indulgences in the 60s and 70s to say, look, you go off and you run the institutions and the arts and culture and academic organizations and infuse them with your rebellion. Rebel more, you know.
I've got a book called Boomers here, which is about like the transition of these people into, there's like a whole chapter on Steve Jobs and the kind of boomer hippie work culture that he tried to institute at Apple and things like that. Just how that process took place when a lot of these people grew up. Speaking of which, how old do you think this girl is here? Over his 13. Shoulder. Because it really does. Whenever I've seen stuff from the communes and these sorts of things, I've always got the kind of questions of abuse kind of just in the back of my mind, because it just really just seems like a dangerous environment for young girls to be around, you know. I remember I watched that Alan Wicker on the 60s, and he goes to some communes and things. Some of those girls are really young and they're in like really predatory environments, you know what I mean? I don't want to sound like a feminist here, but you know,
it
just seems like a dangerous environment for girls to be in. Yeah, Epstein, exactly. Yeah.
And that's part of Leary frames himself here in this little speech he gives about, you know, opting out of these old men's games of society, of war and acquisition. And of course, that message is credibility boosted by the fact that it's an old man saying it. So it seems safe.
You're going to see more and more people taking LSD and making it a part of their lives, so there will be an LSD country within 15 years, an LSD society. There'll be less interest in, obviously, warfare, in power politics. You know, politics today is a disease. That's a real addiction. Politics, 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 politics. Don't politic. Don't vote. These are old men's games. Impotent and senile old men that want to put you onto their old chess games of war and power.
20 years later, the new networks of machines seem to offer a way to construct a real alternate reality. Not just one that was chemically induced, but a space that actually existed in a parallel dimension to the real world. And like with acid, cyberspace could be a place where you would be liberated from the old corrupt hierarchies of politics and power and explore new ways of being. One of the leading exponents of this idea was called John Perry Barlow. In the 60s, he had written songs for the Grateful Dead and been part of the acid counterculture. Now, he organised what he called cyberthons to try and bring the cyberspace movement together.
Well, you know, the cyberthon, as it was originally conceived, was supposed to be the 90s equivalent of the acid test. And we had thought to involve some of the same personnel.
You and I and Timmy should sit down and talk.
Okay, that's good.
And it immediately acquired a financial quality or commercial quality that was initially a little unsettling to an old hippie like me. But as soon as I saw it actually working, then I thought, well, if you're going to have an acid test for the 90s, money better be involved.
Instead of having a glass barrier that separates...
Just want to say that Cyberthon looks like the shittiest nerd party in a warehouse ever.
It does, doesn't it?
You.
I was interested by his clothing. Was he wearing a leather waistcoat?
Leather waistcoat. Yeah.
With a neckerchief.
Yeah, yeah.
You just don't see that enough anymore, do you? It's like a character in a Twin Peaks or something, or a minor David Lynch.
I imagine Simon may own clothes like this.
Yeah. Do you know the Stuart Lee sketch where he's the teacher, like the hip teacher, wearing
a little goatee.
I mean, everybody in the 90s, yeah, we wore waistcoats for a while. We did wear waistcoats with jeans and shirts.
And then they made a comeback through Gareth Southgate, do you remember? What was that thing, the gilet? And everybody was wearing
gilet,
like
Yeah. But that's a bit less the Stuart Lee thing gave it a certain sleaziness, the waistcoat. And I found ever since when I've seen people trapped in that 90s style of, and they wear like brocaded waistcoats and things like that. But you do get that sense of, they will try and get teenage girls drunk.
Go on, yeah.
I also associate it with like bridge on TV. Do you remember, is that too niche? Bridge tournaments on TV. That was a thing.
I actually, do you remember I did that AA Mellow thing? They're all on over on the AA Culture Channel. Behind a paywall now, but I actually reviewed like Championship Bridge.
of course you did.
Yeah, so that was fun.
But
one of my favorite Lee and Herring sketches is the one where they're running like a kind of trendy left wing magazine, and some of the dress stylings there, and the kind of the kind of feminist woman who hates her husband and things. Anyway, let's carry on.
Your mind from the mind of the computer. The computer pulls us inside and creates a world for us.
Incorporates everything that could be incorporated.
Admit it, Simon, you're sitting there wearing that right now. This is what you're wearing.
I would never wear. I might wear a kerchief if I was feeling very exuberant, but a pass.
Yeah. He looks like a kind of hacking guru in a 90s movie, doesn't he? Or like or that guy that Bill and Ted go to or something. He's got that kind of vibe, hasn't he? Like the cool but actually not cool guru, but would have been considered cool at that time.
I don't know why I said I would wear a kerchief. I actually wouldn't wear a kerchief, but I think the fact that I said it represents a heavy subconscious desire.
Ed Dutton still dresses like this.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, interesting thing. I was going to say, I often say some of these peripheral figures that we come across are quite interesting figures to look into. I don't find John Perry Barlow that interesting, actually, and we'll see why The sort of naivety of his cyber libertarianism is exploded pretty quickly. But interesting factoid about him is he was connected with Timothy Leary. He was the appointed lover of Timothy Leary's fifth wife.
What?
By that point, Leary obviously was kind of not interested in the whole, you know, squidgy business of sex. And he said to Barlow, you know, I'd like you to be her kind of lover because I can't give her what she needs anymore. His fifth wife was actually the sister of the actress. Do you remember A View to a Kill? The blonde girl who plays the love interest, Stacey, in View to a Kill. It was her sister who was Leary's fifth wife.
Some totty in that one.
There you go. Yeah.
View to a Kill's got a lot of good totty in it.
That's a weird phenomenon. The only other person I've heard doing that is Tilda Swinton, the actress, you know, who she got a younger boyfriend and like her husband who just gets on with his art or something.
Yeah.
Pretty weird setup, isn't it?
And also Hattie Jakes and John Le Mesurier had that setup.
Yes.
Where he'd be sitting downstairs drinking himself into whiskey oblivion as Hattie Jakes was
romping,
you know, railing some guy upstairs.
Can you imagine?
Really dark. Yeah.
The sound coming from upstairs.
They're one of those couples who got divorced and then remarried as well. Burton and Taylor did that as well. Looking at this guy, he could also be like Sliding Doors, Noel Edmonds. Like if Noel Edmonds made very different life choices, he could have ended up as this guy. But anyway.
Yeah.
Noel Edmonds was at my undergraduate graduation
why?
I was a little bit miffed by that because this was like our big day type thing. All anybody cared about was like, oh, there's Noel Edmonds. there we go. Anyway, let's carry on. Tiny man, by the way. Really small, really. Noel Edmonds is really titchy in real life. But anyway.
Many such cases. Yeah.
Braid's experience itself.
Barlow then wrote a manifesto that he called a Declaration of Independence.
For Zoomers in the chat, Noel Edmonds presented a show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And Tiz was.
Of cyberspace. It was addressed to all politicians, telling them to keep out of this new world. It was going to be incredibly influential, because what Barlow did was give a powerful picture of the internet, not as a network controlled by giant corporations, but instead as a kind of magical, free place, an alternative to the old systems of power. It was a vision that would come to dominate the internet over the next 20 years.
Governments of the industrial world, cyberspace does not lie within your borders. We are creating a world...
Look at all the noobs in the chat. Oh, it wasn't Tiz, was it? It was Swap Shop. He's got that wrong. He's got that wrong. This is where I feel like Stuart Lee. You know,
he hasn't done the most basic research. That's what I was going to say.
I think that shows. Lee, like. I think that shows there's more lurking Gen Xers than we had previously suspected.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, to even know that is a pre-Zennial reference. We didn't watch Tiz.
He did a bifurcating joke, a Gen X reference mixed with a millennial reference.
Exactly.
There you go.
Exactly. I also, for some reason, this has reminded me, I bought Sabutio for AAA. It's coming through the post today. So later on tonight, I'm going to play Sabutio. And I think that's a Gen X thing. I don't really think Sabutio was a thing when I was little, but it was a massive 70s thing, wasn't it?
Oh, no, we had it massively. We played it constantly. No, it's massive fantastic. For Zennials. Yeah, yeah, I had the AC Milan one because it had such a nice kit, and I loved AC Milan. Yeah, we had United, of course. We were Man United fans.
Did they have Maldini, Baresi, Costa Curta, and
They were just little. It just had the little kit. I don't think it really. I don't even know if you knew what player they were. But they had the kit, and it just looked really nice. But the actual game is impossible to play. We used to play it. Me and my brother just flicking them with like a proper flick, where you put your finger into your thumb. That's how you flick, right? But we eventually had like an after-school Sabutio. A guy was like, one of the dads was like, I'll do a Sabutio club sort of thing. But apparently in the real rules, you're not even allowed to flick like that. You have to just use just your finger. Yeah, you're not even allowed to do like a full, apparently, you're not even allowed to do like a full power flick. You're using your pointed finger, to whatever that finger's called, to index finger, just to yeah, do it as a kind of weird sort of lame flick. And there were all kinds of rules. And you end up realizing this is the most incredibly difficult game. It's way too difficult. If you actually play it properly, it's not enjoyable.
Can you have formations in it?
I can't even remember.
The formations are like...
It's incredibly difficult. What much better was that Super Cup football, you know, the one where they went up and down, like the electric one where they went up and down on little rails. Do you remember that one? You could move them up and down with little knobs. I'm not describing it. It's kind of like a mini table football, but on rail. That was so good. But Sabuto is like near impossible.
So do you think 5-year-old AAA, a girl with no interest in football whatsoever... is going to have fun playing this.
She'll be able to mess around with it, but if you ever tried to play a proper game, it would be just incredible. It's one of the most incredibly difficult games.
I think it's a strategy you're adopting to make sure that she doesn't fall in love with football. Before, do you know, because I see around me, there's a couple of schools with kids, primary age schools with playing fields, and you see them all kind of, you know, I go past on the bike and I turn my head and there's kids playing football, like, I guess what, they're 7, 8 years old, stuff like that. And it's like all girls football. And these little girls wandering around looking disconsolate in this football kit. And I'm thinking, yeah, they don't want to play football. Get them out of it early so they can move on to girl interest stuff and they don't have to emulate men. You know.
Yeah, AA might be accidentally contributing to the scourge of this women's football, the great evil of women's football.
Where anyone, anywhere, may express his or her beliefs, no matter how singular, without fear of being coerced into silence or conformity. I declare the global social space
we are building
to be naturally independent of the tyrannies you seek to impose on us. We will create a civilization of the mind in cyberspace. May it be more humane and fair than the world your governments have made before.
It's begun. This is the key to a new order.
It's just a frisbee.
This code disc means freedom.
But two young hackers...
Was Tron the inspiration for the power glove that Nintendo brought out?
Hmm.
Those gloves they had out. That was like meant... That was like one of those things that they made a massive deal of that didn't really take off.
And interesting factoid, Timothy Leary used to wear the power glove on stage sometimes when he was talking about cybernetics. He was interested in this as well.
Really? It was the most exciting... The power glove when you were a kid was the most exciting thing ever. I didn't even have one, but there was like a movie that featured it and you were just like, this was... It just seemed like incredible.
What was that movie called? Pinball Wizard? What was that? Power glove?
Wasn't he in like a tournament? He was actually in like a Nintendo tournament in that film.
I seem to remember it was intimately connected with... Super Mario Brothers 3 coming out.
Isn't it The Wizard? 1989.
The Wizard. That was it. The Wizard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, the Wizard, not Pimble Wizard. The Wizard. That was it.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Go on.
No, I was just going to... I had to look it up. I didn't know what a power glove was, but I came across it with this thing with Leary. And I thought, that's very odd. But yeah, some of his later stage appearances, he would model this thing as a kind of sign of things to come. And then I read about the power glove and it was singularly unsuccessful.
It's like, yeah, Leary's just playing a NES. I mean, that's not that futuristic.
If we don't know what we're talking about, it's a...
It's a grey thing, isn't it?
This thing here. Yeah, this thing. Oh, cool. That glove there.
It just felt like this was like a magical... When you were a kid, you see that. Like, you never even got one. Yeah. You just thought for some reason it was the future.
I never had one. I had an ROB. I had the little robot ROB, but I never had a power glove. So.
Wow. No, neither did I. I was going to say that manifesto. It all just sounded like fairly boilerplate, lefty stuff. The idea of it being more humane and fair. You know, it's like, I get the idea about individual expression, although that's completely backfired, of course, as Curtis will probably get into. And the internet, of course, allows people to censor more than ever. But don't you think it was just fairly like boilerplate lefty, be more humane and fair? I think in a minute he says no hierarchies. I mean, wasn't it a bit lame, this manifesto?
It's a rejection of the authoritarian. It's a classic sort of, you know, I hate my dad, I want to be free. We're going to be on the internet. It's going to be a place of the mind and high culture. And then you realize what the internet is actually reduced to.
Yeah.
I've just realized that the kid from The Wizard, right, is also the kid in The Princess Bride who's reading with Columbo. I never drew that connection before. It's the same kid. Have you seen The Princess Bride, right? Where Columbo is reading a story and there's that, you know, the pit of never-ending despair. It's the same kid. His name was Fred Savage. See what else he was in there. He was in lots of things. He was in Dinosaurs. He did The Princess Bride before he did The Wizard. Wow. So he was in Austin Powers. He was in Austin Powers as number 3/the mole. So there we go. Interesting career for Fred Savage. So let's carry on.
As in New York, thought that Barlow was describing.
Yeah, people are saying he was in The Wonder Years. In The Wonder Years, yeah. Okay.
Very, very millennial heavy references today.
Sorry, You see, this is a thing. We can range back, Sabitio. Exactly. We can range forward, Power Glove.
Yeah.
Wonder, we can just do it all.
This is how it should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
A fantasy world. That his vision bore no relationship at all to what was really emerging online. They were cult figures on the early online scene, and their fans followed and recorded them. They called themselves Fiber Optic and Acid Freak. And they spent their time exploring and breaking into giant computer networks that they knew were the hard realities of modern digital power.
My specific instance, I was charged with conspiracy to commit a few dozen overt acts, they called them, among a number of things having to do with computer trespass and I guess computer eavesdropping, interception, unauthorized access to federal interest computers, which is pretty vague law, communications network computers, and so on.
In a notorious public debate online, the two hackers attacked Barlow. What infuriated them most was Barlow's insistence that there was no hierarchy or controlling powers in the new cyber world. The hackers set out to demonstrate that he was wrong. Acid Freak hacked into the computers.
I'm like elite theory hackers? Being like, it's always the organized minority. And we are going to demonstrate the principles of Vilfredo Pareto and Giancarlo Mosca through the power of hacking. So kind of they're out to prove him wrong. Like, surely this is not true.
There was an element of they were kind of doing it for social status amongst hackers, who obviously are a very select group, and they were genuinely, it does seem they were genuinely curious about how to sort of, you know, deal with phone switching systems and things like that, because you have to remember in these days it was kind of the dial-up modem and it would be prohibitive to be online, so they found ways to trick the phone switching system so they could spend a lot of time going into computer systems. But this guy Fiber Optic, his real name is Mark Abeen. He's now a kind of a tech security consultant, and his other guy there, Acid Freak, is a guy called Elias Ladopoulos, and they're both in this sort of cyber security industry now, but they originally came from a hacker group called Legion of Doom, which was a bit of homage to your recent book there. And there was a guy in there called Eric Bloodaxe, who they fell out with. So that they formed their own group called MOD, Masters of Deception. And they all had names like Corrupt and Scorpion and Outlaw. And they, as Curtis is going to tell us, they did these massive hacks on this company TRW, which is now part of the Experian credit agency. But it was all sorts of telephone companies, Southwestern Bell, New York Telephone, Pacific Bell, all of these companies they went into, even one military electronics and missile company. But they were just sort of keen to learn more, find out how these things worked. They were the autists of the time. They were into computers and they wanted to get more or less status, with hackers. They were brought to trial eventually and Fiber Optic there spent a couple of years in jail. And there was allegations they were trying to obtain things like credit card details and passwords and stuff like that. But one of the things they were sort of acute about was trying to dispel this naive myth that people like Perry Barlow had. And he did acknowledge later on that while the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, tried at first to defend the hackers as these, you know, avatars of exploratory individualism, that he sort of said things later on like, yeah, these kids kind of made our lives really hard because the stuff they were accused of doing did make hacking look sinister in the public eye. And I did regret my kind of naivety in thinking that government wouldn't come in and start to regulate the internet.
Do you know Legion of Doom obviously comes from DC Comics, right? The supervillain league. You know, when they go up against the Justice League, the villain is the Legion of Doom. If you ever watched Super Friends in the late 70s, they were the villains. But Nick will be thinking Legion of Doom are a tag team from wrestling, right? Now, did you know that Vince, they were called the Road Warriors, right? The Legion of Doom. And he made them change their name from Road Warriors to Legion of Doom because he thought it would be too confusing for fans where there's the Ultimate Warrior, right? And there was also, I think, before Kerry Von Erich was made the Texas Tornado, they were calling him like the Power Warrior, or they were calling him some like warrior name as well. So he made them change their name to Legion of Doom. But then at Survivor Series, they were all a team. The Ultimate Warrior, the Legion of Doom, and Kerry Von Erich were a team at one of the Survivor Series. So, kind of a little bit of wrestling trivia.
They were probably the best tag team, weren't they, of the actual tag teams. I don't know what the word is, but, you know, you can have a tag team that's just Hogan.
Within the kayfabe, yeah.
No, what's it called when you have a tag team that's like Hogan and the Warrior decide to have a tag team versus a proper tag team that's Demolition or Legion of Doom or the Bushwhackers? What's the distinction? Yeah. You see what I mean? A tag team proper. They were the best tag team proper, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they were the top of the pecking tree. I don't think they ever lost to anybody.
But is there a name for that when it's just a tag team that's just an ad hoc tag team? Do you see what I mean? That isn't a real... They're like a... You see the difference? There's like two...
Yeah. There's like a super team up where it's like... Hulk Hogan and Ultimate Warrior, or but you know, it'd be like Bruno Sammartino and Bob Backlund. They're going to team up for this one thing. But then, because Legion of Doom was so good, if it was Hogan and Warrior versus the Legion of Doom, you'd probably put your money on Legion of Doom because there would be that thing like, oh, well, they're a well-oiled team. Yeah. Because Hogan and Warrior are two individuals, you know what I mean? So anyway, let's carry on.
Of a giant corporation called TRW. TRW had originally built the systems that ran the Cold War for the US military. They had helped create the delicate balance of terror. Now, TRW had adapted their computers to run a new system, that of credit and debt. Their computers gathered up the credit data of millions of Americans and were being used by the banks to decide individuals' credit ratings. The hackers broke into the TRW network, stole Barlow's credit history, and published it online.
Pause. Okay, sorry, I hate to do a pause. I always feel terrible. This is my first one at 1 hour, 27 minutes. I just want to say that having gone out with an American once, maybe this, I don't know if this is a silly point, people can tell me, but credit score is everything in America in a way it just that traditionally hasn't really been here. Like, you can't get a house. You know what I mean? Maybe it is here, but I remember just Americans being so paranoid about their credit score and constantly thinking and talking about it. And if you mess it up, you can't even like rent somewhere. Whereas it's never really been such a thing. Obviously, if you're getting a mortgage here, yes, but in general, but it just sort of haunted Americans every day of their life from my sort of anecdotal knowledge.
I remember I've never wanted a credit card and I've never like used credit, you know, but I remember getting one. Because my parents said you can't get a credit score. you can't build up a credit score if you don't have a credit card. So they made me get one, and I still got it. I mean, I don't really use it. I mean, I just set it to pay off automatically, or whatever. But I think there is something like if you want to get a mortgage, and you've just used a debit card your whole life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's better if you've used a credit card and paid it off promptly than not having one. Yeah, I hated that as well because I didn't want one. So my ex-girlfriend had terrible debt. So I was like, right, I'm never going to get in debt. I'm just going to cut up my credit card in case I ever when it was tempted. And yes, but they want you to have it. The only time, like I say, when you want a mortgage, you look and you find, oh, there's these weird three companies that are dictating my whole life that have all this weird data on me. And even things like checking things takes points off your credit score, which doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. It's like, oh, if you check it, it could hurt it. I'm like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah. I know.
Well, I need to get a mortgage. So
I know. Yeah. It's insane. All these insane. Anyway, but in America, it was much more at the front of people's minds, in my experience. You know, and even when they were young, even when they weren't looking for a mortgage, just to rent a flat or anything. And it was kind of a constant threat looming. That's why I just think it was significant that they use this credit score.
You know, in America now, right? You can get like a pizza on credit. You can get like a low level loan to get like one Deliveroo, things like that. Higher purchase pizzas. You think I'm making it up? I'm not. People get into like debt traps because they're addicted to getting like pizza on credit. So yeah, sorry. Yeah.
I was gonna say, do you remember back in the sort of mid late 90s, the phenomenon of credit card surfing? You know, there's a girl I was seeing once, and she was, because I didn't really understand it. You know, this idea of using credit anyway. I'm very much live within your means and spend what you have. And she was talking about this, and she had like 7 or 8 credit cards. And on one of them, she said, yeah, I racked about £10,000 debt on this one.
Yeah, I don't get, like, I've never understood that, you know.
I just moved on to the next one because the deal.
I told you the story before. I had a friend, and this was in the 80s, like a school friend, whose parents were always like, had like brand new cars and things. And they had a swimming pool, right? And I know this was like, my mum then wanted to get a house with a swimming pool. But then I remember them saying, like, yeah, it's all on credit, though. Like, they got the swimming pool on credit. And then they decided not to do it. It's kind of like, there was a whole culture of that sort of thing.
I've seen it, because I went out with this person. I've seen it. It accumulates. You end up with these absurd interest rates, you know, in the 20% and things like this. And then they've just got 6 credit cards. Then they have to apply to a company to end up consolidating it down, which you can do. But, it's a nightmare. Debt. And that's when you realize, well, by the way, you can never go out with someone like that because they'll destroy you with their profligate spending. And I know it's her dad had had 2 heart attacks. And I was like, yeah, that will be me.
Profligate, good word.
Thank you.
The hackers were demonstrating the growing power of finance.
He's picked that up off football commentary.
How dare you?
There's certain words that come from the world of football commentary. I reckon profligate is one of them.
Nah.
Yeah.
Really? There are certain,
consummate skill there. You know, and the thing is, like, just things that only football.
Oh, commentary. He's a profligate goal scorer. It'd be something like that.
Prolific.
It'd
be prolific, wouldn't it?
He's prolific. Okay. Yeah. Okay. There are certain weird words that I think it's like just John Motson. Like he had like certain words. Gorilla Monsoon was like that in wrestling as well. The Gorilla Monsoon was like a little dictionary. You know, you pick up a lot. Oh, that was a cardinal mistake for a pro. oh, interesting. Oh, well, I'll write that one down. You know. Anyway, carry on.
Companies that ran the new systems of credit knew more and more about you and increasingly used that information to control your destiny.
Oh, consummate skill and savoir-faire. Alan Wright, of all people. Oh, yeah, carry on.
And the system that was allowing this to happen were the new giant networks of information connected through computer servers. The hackers were questioning whether Barlow's utopian rhetoric about cyberspace might really be a convenient camouflage, hiding the emergence of a new and growing power that was way beyond politics.
We've got Gaddafi.
Can we just pause there? But to summarize or recap there, the hypernormal in that brief episode about cyber libertarianism it's this idea that, you know, digitalization represents this notional freedom and declares this kind of individual empowerment. But the hypernormal state of it is that people know it's not a true reflection of the power dynamics at work. And the network is substituting for visible avatars of power. You know, in the past, it would have been a ruler or an army or a sense of a binding civilization that sort of locates the powerful coordinating principle of a society, and it changes the minds of the people in it. But with this, people know, you know, again, it's that word I used last time, it's hyperstitional. It's an abstract thought, which does have a real power in the world. There's a problem that you as an individual, you don't have any ability to wield what is kind of meaningful power on the network. I mean, AA, you said this, you know, you're a large YouTube account, you're a large, moderately large Twitter account. But you've said, I mean, I think the stream yesterday, you know, I'm no one of any significant power. And it's true. And most of us aren't, even the big accounts. You know, when you engage in this network, power is mediated by this illusion. And this is why Tony Blair has no phone, I think. You know, he deals in the real stuff.
Do you think in a way that Elon Musk buying Twitter actually brought this into focus? Because Musk came in saying, oh, I'm going to go by democracy and Vox Populi and all this bullshit. Yeah. Yeah. And then turned very quickly into an arbitrary and capricious king who just ruled by whim. In a strange way, Elon Musk kind of brought the nature of power into focus, didn't he?
That elides very well with stuff you learn about Gaddafi and his third international theory, which was this idea of not having democracy, running everything by a series of kind of baroque labyrinthine committees, but in the end, none of them really had any power and he had the final say. So in a way, it's very much the kind of same model. And the distribution of power on a network gives you this. I was interested in this thing you were saying about the Stalin video, about the historians who form a kind of lattice of quotations of things which don't chase back to original sources. And it all gains an illusion of strength by repetition and proximity. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's like when we did the stream on the dodgy 1960s flats. They all stay up by the force of their own weight, but they're not bolted together. They don't have any integrity. They're low quality. And in fact, they're dangerous. But that's kind of very similar, that everything is kind of a network that's leaning on everything else and leaning on everything else. And this is why probably there's, you know, this notion of misinformation and the virality and the spread of things that are wrong, that troubles certain people in elites. But this idea that everything becomes a reference to a reference to a reference, you know, all very kind of Baudrillardian. And that's this thing I talked about with the trap of the meme last time, when Curtis is talking about the way that the modern power system derived of Bernays and the century of the self, all that stuff, was that your radical individualism was the thing that was being marketed back to you as the fundamental of that power. So as you participate in that system, so you strengthen the power of that system and you weaken your own power. You're in this paradoxical relationship of, again, leaning on all of these other, this mesh of stuff that's kind of, you know, it's vaporous. It's not really meaningful in real power terms. And as you say, Elon can be the great sort of, you know, puppet master over something like that.
Yeah. Slight tangent here, but just before we came on air, Nick, you were talking about modern flats and so on, and you just mentioned the high rises, Simon.
Mm.
Last time I was in London with AAA, she was looking at the massive high rises, and in her 5-year-old mind, for some reason, she's always been obsessed with tallness and bigness, and bigger means better. Like, she's always obsessed with, like, who's taller, who's bigger, what is bigger. And she's like, I want to live in one of those big towers. Like, no, honestly, you don't want to live up there. Think of how long it would take to get up there. It's really hot and so on. But she's become obsessed with this idea now. And now she's keeps on drawing. She's like, this is where I'm going to live when I grow up. And she's like drawing really tall, high rise blocks. And like saying, well, this is going to be my bedroom. I think in her imagination, people live in the entire, like, I don't think she understands that they're all different flats. I think she thinks you live in the entire tower, almost like a castle or something. So
I think she's got a success mindset. She wants the penthouse, she knows it's the most sought after. Also reminds me of Camus. I think it was The Rebel, where the protagonist just wants to always be on the tallest possible place he can be, on the highest place. That just came back to me from like 20 odd years ago, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. Yeah, I can't remember why.
She is putting her bedroom right at the top as well, interestingly. So let's go, it's coming on.
Outer space was not the only imaginary story being created. Faced with the humiliating defeat in the Lebanon, President Reagan's government was desperate to shore up the vision of a moral world where a good America struggled against evil. And to do this, they were going to create a simple villain, an imaginary enemy, one that would free them from the paralyzing complexity of real Middle Eastern politics. And the perfect candidate was waiting in the wings. Colonel Gaddafi, the ruler of Libya.
Now, as we get into Gaddafi, I have to give my dictator top Trump's précis, right? I am of the opinion that young Gaddafi was very Chad-like.
Yeah.
Right. If you see Gaddafi like in the 60s, or even in the 70s, big, strong jawline, kind of looks like a Libyan Chad. But at some point, he undergoes that process and looks and ends up looking like a kind of, you know, burnt out lesbian or something, a bit like Keith Richards or someone like that. Yeah. And I'm wondering when, like, are we using this film? Can we pinpoint the exact moment he goes from being Chad Gaddafi to like lesbian Gaddafi?
Tricky. It's, I feel at this point, we, you know, once we get in, we should actually have a compulsory stop and do an internet image search for, you know, his dictator drip. Because if you just search for Gaddafi fashion, I mean, yeah.
Let's have a look. Gaddafi.
Astonishing array of styles. Like you say, he goes to that sort of late stage of kind of Phil Spector hair and sort of a squidgy spitting image kind of face.
Okay. So, I mean, yeah. Look at this.
Some great outfits.
Absolutely ridiculous.
I posted a few earlier on. There's just brilliant things.
Let's just look at this drip.
That's amazing. Baby blue medals stick.
With Berlusconi there.
Yeah.
Look at that. He's gone for some African sheet. This is the
That Berlusconi shot, actually, interestingly, what he did was on the plane over, he improvised. On his right breast, you can just see if you zoom in, he's got... he posted a picture of a Libyan freedom fighter who was executed by the Italians. So he wanted it right in Berlusconi's sight. He got a little photograph and somebody on the plane put a little red board around it and then they pinned it onto his uniform.
Oh, look, this is from a Vanity Fair article that's looking at...
Yeah.
Literally a Vanity Fair article looking at a life in fashion.
I posted some pictures from this earlier because there's a fascinating array of looks that he had. Just amazing.
Yeah, there. I mean, this is clearly from the lesbian era.
Yeah.
I suppose if you're a fake dictator created by the West, you've probably got quite a lot of time and money, and you're not doing any real dictating, so you probably do get into fashion, don't you?
So look, here he is in 1984, and I still think he's got... This is late Chad Gaddafi, before he's...
Sort of James Brown look.
Miami Vice era.
Miami Vice, yeah. Not too dissimilar from... One of my regular outfits with the black T-shirt and the...
You're saying that as if you didn't actually take it from there.
Yeah.
From Gaddafi. But,
coincidentally.
Here he is in 99, and he's clearly lesbian Gaddafi by here.
I mean, I just go back to that comment, Nick May. That's, I think, a very perceptive comment there about what Gaddafi represents, as we see in this story. He is kind of... Remember I said... last week, you tend to notice that in the sort of mid-20th century totalitarian regimes, the higher up the food chain you went to the leader, the uniforms were simplified down. So the leader was wearing a very austere, bare uniform. Mm-hmm. And yet it doesn't apply to Gaddafi. And I think he's an exception because he was a theatrical simulation of a leader. Yeah, he had all the kind of mimetics in his
look. Hyper-normal, hyper-real.
Yeah, exactly. And not the real thing. And we see, you know, he is kind of more or less set up to be that bogeyman.
What's this outfit he got here?
He's sharing his screen.
Hold on a minute. I mean, what was that one? He put the face. Is it the faces?
Yeah. NASA on there. You see, just on his right. He was a big fan of NASA as a pan-Arabist.
And, good to get the faces of everyone you've killed on your top as a dictator.
It's probably, I think, France Fanon, I think, might be on there.
Oh, here's a, here's a good one. Where's it from? Reddit. Look, they put them all lots together. See, there's Chad Gaddafi in the bottom right.
That was when he was in the military academy in Benghazi. He came over to Britain in the mid-60s, in 1966, to do a course at, I think, Bovington, communications course. And we'll see a little bit about him relating his experience in Britain. But there was kind of mixed opinions about him. There was an officer who was running his course in England who said he was an amusing officer, always cheerful, hardworking and conscientious, who successfully overcame challenges learning English. Although it's said that he did stubbornly refuse to learn English and he was quite rude towards British officers and he ultimately failed his exams.
Would we agree that he is a 20 in dictator drip?
Totally.
In the top Trumps, would he be a top Trump for in the fashion category? Would you agree with that?
Just for sheer range.
Does he have a cape?
He does. He's one of the pictures then, on the research. Yeah, he had a
cape.
Because there's a famous image of a certain dictator who has a cape, and I always think that's the ultimate.
I think it's not as well defined as that particular cape, but there was a shot of him in France. In a sort of big, thick coat and a cape as well.
Is it this one? I think it's this one.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to me...
It's a bit soft for a cape. I'm not sure. I have to see it.
To me, the champion of the cape is still been... I mean, look at that. Oh,
it needs the military uniform. And it needs the gloves, doesn't it, almost? You know,
I think he might be I think he might be a 19 because he doesn't quite achieve this.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on.
You notice there Pinochet's uniform, you know, no stacks of medals, mostly quite austere, grey, simple, but he accessorizes. I mean, we need Pharaoh here for this. He accessorizes brilliantly.
Just
that's like the picture. That's like your byline picture on your author website, that picture there. That's what you've taken inspiration from. Folded arms. You don't fold your arms, but there's the stare. Yeah.
All right. I took that shot because they were like, "Oh, we need a picture for this website." It's like, "Oh shit!" Yeah. So, and I happened to be doing like an interview that day with somebody. It could have been with you, Nick. I can't remember, but I had to do like an interview that day, so I was already in a suit. So, I was like, all right, I'll just take one in front of my bookshelves. Anyway,
you did the two shots. You did the slightly more whimsical one, which I thought was good, but everybody else thought you should go with the stern.
Yeah, I was smiling in one and looking straight down and moody in the other. Yeah. Everybody in the little group chat went for the other one. So
Gaddafi was very into football, by the way, as well, I should just add.
The Americans were going to ruthlessly use Colonel Gaddafi to create a fake terrorist mastermind. And Gaddafi was going to happily play along, because it would turn him into a famous global figure.
Pause. I hate to pause again so soon. Isn't that a bit of a Faustian bargain? Like, I'm going to be the West's villain. Yeah, I'll play along with that role. Like, couldn't you see that role just going awry quite easily? You see what I mean? It's like, I'll be the ultimate villain for them. It's like, yeah, but then you'll put yourself in terrible danger.
Yeah, trust me, says the State Department.
Yeah, I just think it's playing with fire. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Looks a bit like Russell Brand there, by the way.
That's another good Stuart Lee bit, by the way. It's a bit on Russell Brand. Anyway, let's carry on. What happened to Russell, by the way? Is he still around? Is he still doing a show? Or
for legal reasons, this part of the stream has been removed.
is he in jail? Like, what happened to Russell Brand? Is he still
allegedly
going? Still around?
He's very nice.
Great guy.
Did you ever meet Russell Brand, Nick?
I did not. No, but and for like, I agree with Simon. I'm not going to say too much about him. There was always sorts of talk about Russell Brand, but he always managed to. Anyway, this part of the stream has been. Yeah, well, yeah. No, I never met him.
He famously said that he slept with over 1,000 women, and that is one thing that is known about Russell Brand. And I believe him.
Good on the boy. He's come from nothing.
I always liked Russell Brand. I used to listen to his show, and I liked his playfulness with language.
Yeah.
And he kind of adopted a kind of weird Dickensian character.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's carry on. And also, him looking exactly like Nigella Lawson kind of put me in a bit of a bind. I was like, does that mean I kind of fancy Russell Brand?
You had a moment of libidinal confusion.
Or do I like Nigella Lawson less?
Does he really look like Nigella Lawson?
Honestly, you look at those two side by side.
Some angle.
It's the same person.
Yeah.
Only like put a beard on Nigella Lawson, it's literally Russell Brand.
So. The heaving bosom. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, give or take a couple of details.
Yeah.
Colonel Gaddafi had taken power in a coup in the 1970s. But from the very start, he was convinced that he was more than just the leader of one country. He believed that he was an international revolutionary whose destiny was to challenge the power of the West.
Mm. White milk there.
Gentlemen, the Queen.
When he was a young officer, Gaddafi had been sent to England for training. And he had detested the patronising racism that he said he had found at the heart of British society.
Yes, I attended a course. I have been in England since 1966, from April to August.
You had the best months.
I was in Buckensfield, a village called Buckensfield, in army school.
Pause.
In fact, we...
Just interesting detail there. He was doing his course in Beaconsfield. He also quite liked High Wycombe, apparently.
Did he?
Yes.
He wouldn't like it now.
No. he's going to say something interesting, though, in a minute. He's going to be prompted, and he's going to say something interesting about the experience he had with British officers. And he'll describe what happened.
Ill-treated in that place. From some British officers. I think those officers were Jews, maybe Jews.
Ill-treated in what sort of way?
In many ways.
Did I hear him correctly there, Simon?
Yes.
Sorry, I was just okay.
Yeah,
it took a couple of moments to register there. Okay.
Yeah,
the narrator sort of left it out, didn't they? They said he experienced racism, and then you're like, oh, well, it's not exactly how he framed it, but
yeah, yeah. Curtis Edson narrates a bit about this on his blog. He does an article about Gaddafi, which I'll repost, and he says, you know, Gaddafi's kind of doing this interview and he's talking about the sort of racism he encounters in Britain. And this is one of Curtis's central motifs that you see develop later in Can't Get You Out of My Head. There's a fundamental racism in Britain. And Curtis is talking about this interview and he says, and Gaddafi's doing really well. And then he says this.
What the racism he experienced was from
the specific group. Yeah.
I mean, does anybody not believe him? I totally believe him. I totally believe that in 1966, his encounter with these people would have resulted in racism. I absolutely do believe it.
They ill-treat us every time.
By being rude or by being bullying or...
In their own behavior towards us, they ill-treat us. They hate us anyhow. Because of colonization. It is a result of colonialism.
Once in power, Gaddafi had developed his own revolutionary theory, which he called the Third Universal Theory. It was an alternative, he said, to communism and capitalism. He published it in a green book, but practically no one read it. He had sent money and weapons.
Can I just say, that hasn't been done before. A third way between communism and capitalism. It's been done before, mate. Mm. I mean, come on. What was fascism?
But who's going to tell him that? You know what I mean?
He must have done something.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Love your green book. You know, when you're a dictator or even a fake one, everyone's got to go, oh, yeah, yeah, brilliant. Yeah, no one's thought of this third way before. He's like, thank you.
Yeah, this is, it's got various names, Third International Theory, you know, Third Universal Theory. And this was the famous Green Book. And Curtis says in the blog, traditional democracy as practiced in Britain and America was a sham, he said. It was actually a form of dictatorship. All the party needed was 51% of the vote, and it could then impose its ideas on everyone for 4 or 5 years, just like the clans in Libya did. The alternative was a new kind of direct democracy in which the people governed themselves. There were no parties. Instead, people's committees elected people's congresses that would manage things. Then there were revolutionary committees that made sure the congresses and their administrators did things in a revolutionary way. In reality, it was a one-man show. Gaddafi made decisions about everything and played all the different committees and congresses off against each other to maintain his power. Shades of Uncle Joe? I don't know.
And now I won't hear slander like that. As you heard from Professor Fur yesterday,
absolutely,
Stalin was regularly outvoted, couldn't get his way. He wanted a more direct democracy. He wanted a two-party system, a competitive democracy, and he was voted down in the Politburo.
Yeah. Djugashvili did nothing wrong.
This is my favourite Stalin apologist channel, by the way, of the 6 or 7 I subscribe to. AA is perhaps the best.
You know, Gaddafi's critique, as Simon laid it out, started off so well. I was, he sounds like the populist illusion here. But then it kind of quickly veers off into nonsense. Oh, I want more. The problem is it's not democratic enough. I want to make it more. You know, you should have been more honest, Mohammed. Anyway.
To the IRA in Ireland to help them overthrow the British ruling class. But all the other Arab leaders rejected him and his ideas. They thought that he was mad.
Well, I tell you what, I changed from the first cigar, which was Saint Louis Ray Regios. Now I've moved over to the Vegas or Urbana Formoso. I've got a video about cigars coming out tomorrow for cigar fans. And I tell you what, I think Grok was wrong. I think I've done it in the right order. What a smooth transition. This one is a perfect dessert. Anyway, let's carry on.
And by the mid-1980s, Gaddafi was an isolated figure with no...
Can I just say about the reading, the Stalin stuff and the communists and so on? I actually do like their idea of calling each other comrade. There's a guy in the chat saying Comrade Dixon is being a bit mouthy. I actually think it's really good for like solidarity. And even when I was in touch with Professor Fur, he signed off his last email to me. Thanks again and solidarity. And I was like, oh, solidarity. It's nice. I mean, I explained to him I'm not a Marxist, but he still signed off with that. And I just think like it must, if you keep on calling each other comrade all the time, it must build up a kind of unconscious thing, because you're constantly, it's basically saying like, friend Nick, what do you think? Friend Simon, what do you think? I mean, it's like
brother,
brother Nick, brother Simon. And I was thinking like, what could we have? Okay, it's comrades being used, brothers being used by the monks and so on. You know, I've noticed in certain other circles, they call each other freighter and things like that. I mean,
there's a really good one they use in rap. Never mind.
The Wu-Tang Clan call each other God. What up, God? Hey, God. How you doing, God?
It's a bit much.
You know, I'm just like, there's got to be something, though. There's got to be some, like...
I love that you were like, I'm not a Marxist. He was like, yet, comrade, yet.
All right, let's carry on.
Friends and no global influence. Then suddenly that changed. In December 1985, terrorists attacked Rome and Vienna airports simultaneously.
I mean, we got Fren, you know, where it's F-R-E-N. Well, we're just using that as a formal title, you know, Fren Nick, Fren Simon.
Not bad.
I, I don't know. I feel like we need something. It would help build a sense of togetherness, you know?
Yeah. It's going to be Comrade by the end of the week, folks. And next week, Billy Bragg will be joining us.
Killing 19 people, including 5 Americans. There was growing pressure on President Reagan to retaliate.
It's time to rename your State Department the Capitulation Department. Get off of your stick, Mr. President. The American people are sick and tired of being kicked around. You talk
a lot.
Let's say you use some of these billions and billions.
I've just got to add that chap there speaking was a U.S. representative in the Congress for Arkansas. And I kid you not, his name was Tommy Robinson. He used to be a really hardcore sheriff in one of the counties in Arkansas. He was the kind of guy, I found interesting anecdotes about him, and he arrested some guys and there was no detention space in the sheriff's HQ. So he went to the county jail to give prisoners over to the warden to take in, and the warden refused. So he just chained them to the front gates of the prison. Kind of guy he was.
Wow. See, there was a man who could get things done.
And there were some judges who denied funding and he had them arrested.
Wow.
Incredible.
Yeah. There's a little known David Bowie song from his Never Listen To 1987 album called Never Let Me Down. It's called Day In, Day Out. And I've always loved the start of that because Bowie starts, he says, I know when to go out. I know when to stay in.
Yeah,
I get things done. And then the song starts. Just think it's a cool little intro. And I might see if I can. I like the idea of just getting things done, you know. So
billions and billions of dollars worth of weapons that you've asked us to approve. Your words are cheap talk.
President Reagan immediately announced that Colonel Gaddafi was definitely behind the attacks.
These murderers could not carry out their crimes without the sanctuary and support provided by regimes such as Colonel Gaddafi's in Libya. The Rome and Vienna murders are only the latest in a series of brutal terrorist acts committed with Gaddafi's backing.
But the European security services, who investigated the attacks, were convinced that Libya was not involved at all, and that the mastermind behind the attacks was in fact Syria. That the terrorists had been directed by the Syrian intelligence agencies.
But the Americans say that the attack at Rome Airport was organized by Gaddafi, not by Damascus.
No.
Poor
Italian, like head of Italian MI6 or whatever, not briefed on the kayfabe.
They
didn't include him on the memo. It's like, mate.
Yeah. Yeah. The way the case looks, it does look like Syria were more likely to have been involved in the airport attacks than the Libyans. Curtis goes on to describe there was another attack on a disco in West Germany later on. That was likely more to be connected by Libyan intelligence. There were confessions and there were other bits of strong evidence. But in this case, it does look like it was a bit of a distraction to blame Libya.
We don't have any evidence.
You have no
supporting
evidence
supporting such.
And didn't basically Bin Laden do this as well? Or like, I mean, ISIS and Al Qaeda, as Curtis has covered before, frequently took credit for stuff that they hadn't really been involved with.
Hmm.
It's like, oh, there was a suicide bombing over here, or there's something over there. They were like, yeah, that was us. We did it.
Yeah, but I wrote down much like Bin Laden. I didn't want to pause because I felt there's been too many for the poor audience. But yeah, I agree. And can I just say one point on that? I was going to say it later, but since you paused, have you seen the movie The Drop?
No.
With Tom Hardy, James Gandolfini's last film. Very, very good. It's one of those that creeps up on you. You think it's a 3-star film. The more you watch it, you're like, hang on, this is actually really good. I've watched it like some ridiculous amount of times. It's so good, but I don't want to give us spoilers. But the thing about that is, what you learn from that movie is you've got to be careful if you take credit for a crime you haven't actually done, because the real guy is still out there. That's what I thought when I was watching this whole section. When you start taking credits for crimes, isn't that one of the main problems with it?
Yes, yeah, it's very ill thought out, I would say. Also, I think I'm being corrected. I think that line, I know when to go out and when to stay in and get things done, is at the start of Modern Love, not the start of Day in, Day Out. Is that right?
It's the one that goes na 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 na. I can't remember it doesn't have many lyrics at all.
Yes, Modern Love.
Yeah,
shit,
yeah.
That's from Let's Dance.
Yeah, I didn't pick you up because Bowie's one of my weak points in music, one of my very few.
Oh, all right. Okay. Well, I knew it was from the 80s. Okay, yeah. That's right. That's right. Sorry, Bowie fans.
Affirmation.
Now, there's a wrestling connection, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody here know what the wrestling connection is between David Bowie and specifically that song Modern Love and pro wrestling? When Vince McMahon took over from his dad in 1983, he immediately changed the theme song of Championship Wrestling, which was like a sleazy old 70s jazz team, to Bowie's Modern Love. So if you watch wrestling in that era, the theme tune is Modern Love. And I think they keep it as Modern Love until Hogan comes in, and then they change. I think for a period, it's Michael Jackson's Thriller. And then the record companies were like, hold on, did you ask for permission to use this? And Vince was like, no. And they were like, yeah, you're not allowed to use Michael Jackson as your theme tune. And so that's when he started making his own. That's when he got in Jim Johnson and Jimmy Hart and all them and started writing his own theme tunes and his own music in 85. So a little bit of a pro wrestling lore there. Anyway, let's carry on.
The only evidence we have shows a Syrian connection.
Do you say that it was Libya, and the president said the evidence of Libya's culpability was irrefutable?
Yeah.
But the Italian authorities to whom I've spoken say emphatically on the record that their investigations have shown that it was entirely masterminded by Syria.
I don't agree with that at all.
Well, they've interrogated the surviving terrorists.
I must just say I don't agree with that.
But you've no evidence that Libya was in on the planning either.
Our evidence on Libya is circumstantial but very strong.
But why does the president then say it's irrefutable if you call it circumstantial?
Well, people can be convicted and sentenced in our courts on circumstantial evidence.
But what made it even more confusing was that although there seemed to be no evidence that Gaddafi had been behind the attacks, he made no attempt to deny the allegations. Instead, he went the other way and turned the crisis into a global drama.
It is not a time of saying it is a time of work, time of confrontation.
Threatening suicide attacks against America.
This hostile position can only be explained in racist and crusade terms. Suicidal attacks will have to be an answer to a military attack. But Libya is not affected by such measures that Reagan has declared. Stinking rotten crusader.
Gaddafi now started to play a role that was going to become very familiar.
Fashion.
Looks like Columbo is the role he's playing there.
Yeah, but didn't you think in the previous scene he kind of lost it, though? He looked like he was going to a bridge evening, but he might have to go fishing. They had to like a windbreaker just in case.
That jacket there reminds me of that film Wings of Desire.
Oh, the Vim Vendors.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure like everybody in that film rocks like really cool coats. Isn't Columbo in that movie as well?
God. I mean, Falk.
Yeah, Peter I think Falk. Peter Falk. This is the third Peter Falk reference because I mentioned he was also in Princess Bride. But I'm pretty sure he's in Desire as well.
I think he is. I think, yeah. I've got a very populist take on Wings of Desire, which is it's kind of pretentious rubbish, whereas City of Angels, the loose remake, is far better.
Uh-huh.
I didn't enjoy Wings of Desire. So fucking boring. I don't really like slow films.
That was such a liberal hipster film back in the 90s.
City of Angels is great, isn't it? Nick Cage, come on, 1998, peak movie decade, the 90s.
Hmm.
No one getting no support here.
He grabbed the publicity that had been given to him by the Americans and used it dramatically. He promoted himself as an international revolutionary who had helped to liberate oppressed peoples around the world, even the blacks in America. Gaddafi arranged for a live satellite link to a mass meeting of the Nation of Islam in Chicago.
Brothers and sisters, it is with great honor and privilege that I present to you the leader of the al-Fatah revolution from Libya, our brother Muammar al-Gaddafi.
Gaddafi told them that Libya was now their ally in their struggle against white America.
To express my full support and support of my country to your struggle for freedom, for emancipation.
Gaddafi promised that he would supply weapons to create a black army in America of 400,000 men. If white America refuses to accept blacks as US citizens, he told them, it must therefore be destroyed.
Do you think Gaddafi was in touch with Chuck D and Public Enemy? I bet you anything there's some weird connection. Professor Griff was in like direct contact with Gaddafi.
You mean because of the Farrakhan link?
It's a weird thing about Public Enemy, which fascinated me when I was a kid, right? Because they were into all this sort of politics, right? Is they're the only group that had a security team as part of the group. Didn't rap, didn't do any music. Can't remember what was the name of this. They had like a secure, but they were credited on everything. They were called like the SW1s or something. They were the security wing of Public Enemy. Like, what? Why have you got a security team? You're just a rap group. You know, you're just a music act. That's always fascinated me. There's a few other like weird characters like that. Happy Mondays famously had, what was that guy? Bez.
Yeah.
The guy who just danced on the side of the stage.
I wonder if you're going to mention that. And the Stone Roses in the early days had Cressa, who was the same thing as Bez, but far less known. But yeah, you're right. SW1, which stands for Security of the First World. That's quite a strange thing. That sounds a bit kind of imperialist for Public Enemy, doesn't it?
It's just a weird... Like, Public Enemy is a weird group because they had Terminator X, who was the producer, Chuck D, who was the rapper. But there was about like 15 of them who didn't do anything. I mean, Flavor Flav just went on the... He had the big clock and he was like, but he didn't rap, though. He was just like around...
He does a kind of rap in what's the song? He Got Game. He does a kind of rap at the end. He says, "Watch out for the spirit snipers who'll steal your soul." And all. Yeah, it's more. It's not really a rap. Is it? It's more of a sort of series of hype shouting at the end. Yeah, you're probably right.
But they're a very strange group because they had a lot of members who didn't do anything. Which I've never quite understood. I mean, look, there's Public Enemy. If you have a look at them, right? This dude made the music. One of them rapped. Who are the other dudes? What are they doing? Like, what are they doing? Look at the S. Look, the security crew. They just basically LARPed in the background, looking a little bit like African dictators.
To be fair, wouldn't Tupac and Biggie still be around if they had security crews? So actually... Don't you need a security crew in that kind of line of work, if we're being honest?
So there we go. There we go. The weird thing. The other group a bit like that actually were Prodigy. For a long time, Prodigy was just like the music is just all one guy. And the other members like Maxim and Keith Flint and there was like three other guys. They were just credited as dancers, like the dancers. But then over time, they kind of became part of the group and did more vocal bits as well.
Yeah.
So by the time you get to Breathe and Fat of the Land, I think they're like officially part of the band. But at some point, they were like just dancers. But anyway.
Have you ever seen Jason Statham dancing on that Shaman video?
No, I haven't actually. Jason Statham is in the Shaman
video. He was in a Shaman video dancing. Yeah, yeah. You knew he used to be a diver, didn't he, and a dancer. But anyway, this is getting a bit ridiculous, but yeah, pointless.
Simon's pulling his hair out. Let's get back.
I love that kind of trivia. I mean, I was just thinking about the Shaman, Ebenezer Good, and Jerry Sadovitz doing his cameo in that. You know,
I mean,
I'm just going to add a few bits and pieces. I mean, Gaddafi did, he was encouraging revolutionary groups in various places, obviously famously the IRA, to fight a revolutionary struggle. You know, they'd send out guns and Semtex on old fishing boats back to England, back to Ireland, I should say.
This is Jason Statham as a prodigy backup dancer. Wow.
That's not him.
That's not him. That's someone different. But nonetheless.
Oh. It was Shaman.
Let me see if I can find it. Shaman.
Yeah, this is important.
Shaman.
This is really important.
Got to get it right.
Is that
there
in there?
Top left, top left. No, there.
Here.
See him. Better one is.
Oh, that's
one.
It.
There he is. Yeah, yeah.
What the muscle dude?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
Like gold underpants or something.
Oh, fucking hell. I'm going to have to watch immediately after the stream. I'm going to be watching Prodigy.
Yeah.
Shaman.
Okay.
Very brave costume.
It's mental.
Just to say also, Gaddafi had a few interesting plots up his arm, up his sleeve. He wanted to send a submarine to torpedo the QE2. And he also funded a party, a left-wing revolutionary party in Britain. It was called the Workers' Revolutionary Party. It was run by a paranoid Trotskyite called Jerry Healy, who Curtis says believed all other Trotskyites were really CIA double agents. And Jerry Healy...
Probably correctly, to be honest.
He said Healy also secretly liked forcing lots of young female comrades to have sex with him for the sake of the revolution, in quotes. They held an inquiry in the 1980s as to what actually happened. Apparently the report is still secret, but parts of it were published. But he said bits of it, if they were true, they say that the Workers' Revolutionary Party in 1976 signed a secret deal with the Libyan government for, quotes, providing intelligence information on the activities, names, and positions held in finance, politics, business, communications, media, and elsewhere by, quote, Zionists. And their one of their big spokesmen was Corin Redgrave, the actor. And Vanessa Redgrave was big in the Workers' Revolutionary Party. And apparently Corin Redgrave, he agreed to use the party as Colonel Gaddafi's spy agency in Britain and feed him information about, quote, prominent Jews in British society. So actors there.
It is relevant. Can I just say, I've had it with these Trotskyites, because you've got Starmer, who's a Pavloite, right, which is a subset of Trotskyism, as Peter Hitchens always talks about. But then I also realised that listening to AA's interview, they all became neocons, which I wasn't fully aware of.
Weird.
And also, they keep spreading all this propaganda about Stalin, our great leader. So that's the other thing I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if they lied about him, what else did they lie about?
Right.
Anyway, let's carry on.
Gaddafi also invited a group of German rocket scientists to come to Libya to build him a rocket. He insisted it had no military purpose. Libya was now going to explore outer space.
I think it is peaceful and civil activity. For investigation of space and something like this. And it has nothing to do with any military things.
But no one believed him. Journalists warned that Gaddafi was really preparing to attack Europe, vividly dramatizing the new danger.
That is something like this, which goes that way, to put something into space. But the same device, tilted, say, to an angle of 45 degrees, could, of course, become something very different. A missile possibly carrying a warhead.
That would put Libya within range of an enormous area.
Sorry to pause it and come back to Prodigy, but I actually got something wrong. Maxim apparently was always a vocalist and beatboxer. But did you know that Maxim, who is the, you know, the black guy who does vocals for Prodigy, his real name was also Keith, which reminds me a little bit.
I changed it.
Like his name was, it reminds me a little bit of like Dwayne Dibley or something. It's like, whereas for Keith Flint,
it works.
You never think, oh yeah, your name's Keith though. Somehow Keith Flint gets away with being called Keith.
Yeah.
But Maxim, you can see why he changed his name. So yeah, anyway, let's carry on.
Chilling proposition with its range of 2,000 kilometers.
The Americans and Gaddafi now became locked together in a cycle of mutual reinforcement. In the process, a powerful new image was created that was going to capture the imagination of the West. Gaddafi became a global supervillain, at the head of what was called a rogue state. A madman who threatened the stability of the world. And Gaddafi was loving every minute of it.
Does he think in the past his decisions sometimes have been taken too quickly?
Maybe.
On world affairs?
Maybe.
I think sometimes that is what has made people in the world nervous of you, perhaps.
Pause. Just that expression on his face there. I like to imagine it's maybe only just occurring to him at that point that he's been set up. The way his eyes look like he's thinking.
I mean, yeah. I don't know if it's just the fact he's of his accent or what, but he doesn't seem that bright to me.
He wasn't very well educated, no.
I was thinking, are you really a fake dictator unless you can laugh maniacally at nothing? You know what I mean? He reached that stage where he's just like, I'll just wear a white sheet, I'll laugh at nothing, then look around for a bit. I don't think he might have jumped the shark a little bit at this stage.
It's what this is like. It's like, I mean, Nick will know about this, but there's the Bill Hicks, the comedian, does the routine where he talks about the film Shane, and there's a scene where Jack Palance has to pick up the gun. He throws the gun to the herder who doesn't want to pick it up. He picks it up. Jack Palance's character shoots him, says, "You all saw him. He had a gun." But that is apparently an apocryphal story because there is no Jack Palance character who does that in Shane.
Yeah, I watched it.
Yeah, it's not actually there. So, and again, that's another example of a bit of a hyper-normalization. But that's, in a sense, the anecdote that expresses what Gaddafi, the position he's being put in. He had a gun.
That's what I said. It starts a dangerous game. It's a sort of Faustian bargain. It's like, yeah, I'll be your villain. I'll be the villain of the most powerful country in the world, sure.
Hmm.
Then there was another terrorist attack at a discotheque in West Berlin. A bomb killed an American soldier and injured hundreds. The Americans released what they said were intercepts by the National Security Agency that proved that Colonel Gaddafi was behind the bombing, and a dossier that they said proved that he was also the mastermind behind a whole range of other attacks. President Reagan ordered the Pentagon to prepare to bomb Libya. But again, there were doubts. This time, within the American government itself. There were concerns that analysts were being pressured to make a case that didn't really exist. And to do it, they were taking Gaddafi's rhetoric about himself as a global revolutionary and his manic ravings, and then representing them as fact. And in the process, together, the Americans and Gaddafi were constructing a fictional world.
The analyst was certainly, I'm convinced, pressured into developing a prima facie case against the Libyan government. From the somewhat incoherent ravings of a maniac, both interceptions of a clandestine nature and interceptions of a open radio broadcast or whatever, as well as other sources, quotations of his, that one can assemble a neatly put together package demonstrating that the man had violent interests against the United States and its European allies.
The European intelligence agencies told the Americans that they were wrong, that it was Syria that was behind the bombing, not Libya. But the Americans had decided to attack Libya because they couldn't face the dangerous consequences of attacking Syria. Instead, they went for Gaddafi, a man without friends or allies.
Libya had, or less, downside consequences, if you will. There's less Arab support for Gaddafi.
Truly pathetic behavior from America, to be honest. It's kind of like the world superpower, just weaselly behavior. Oh yeah, we can probably get away with this one, so let's just attack him instead. You know,
could it be a perverse example of social utility of bullying?
Do you know what struck me about this? Maybe I'm getting my dates wrong or something, but the fact they're admitting this now and he's saying this, isn't that a bit of a problem? Because then why can't they do it again, e.g. with Bin Laden? It's kind of like the fact that we know about Operation Northwoods, right, always makes me think, well, then why can't they do that with a 9/11? If they consider the plan, admittedly, they didn't go through with it. In 1962, where they were going to, you know, stage attacks and blame it on the Cuban government, doesn't that open the possibility that it's quite easy to imagine them therefore doing that again? And doesn't the whole Gaddafi thing, they're kind of like, oh yeah, we did that. Doesn't it kind of prove that, well, then they could just do it with Bin Laden or anyone else?
That's crazy conspiracy theory, Nick.
I would just like to state for the record that the official view of the academic agency, my friends, and this channel is that 9/11 happened exactly the way that the Pentagon said it did.
And I'm saying that as well, but I'm saying it just raises the possibility that those kinds of things happen. That's all. And it just makes it a bit...
It's spreading dangerous misinformation.
Sorry to on your channel. I know this is a wrestling and Stalin channel. I'm so sorry.
Yes, the Constantine kissing meme. You know it?
No.
That meme that goes round of... there's a meme with Constantine kissing his face saying, mate, you're spreading dangerous misinformation.
mate.
Find it. I'll see if I can find somebody. Post it for me, and I'll show it on the screen.
There he is, officer. The avatar at the bottom of the screen. That's him. What done it?
We figured there would be less Soviet support for Gaddafi. There's no question but what Libya was more vulnerable than Syria and Iran.
He was a soft
target.
That
is certainly an element, of course.
In April 1986, the Americans attacked Libya. Their targets included Colonel Gaddafi's own house. Immediately after the attack, Gaddafi appeared in the ruins to describe what had happened.
The family were asleep, and my wife was, that day, tied down to the bed because she had a slip disc. I tried to rescue the children, and the house started to collapse, as you can see, and the books started to burn. They concentrated on the children's room so that they would kill all the children. Our small adopted daughter was killed, and two of our children were injured.
But yet again, Gaddafi might have been lying. Ever since then, there have been rumors that his adopted daughter actually survived. But many other children were killed in the raid because the American bombing was so inaccurate. Gaddafi realized that the attention of the whole world was now focused on him, and he grabbed the moment to promote his own revolutionary theory, the Third Way, as a global alternative to democracy.
I feel that I'm really responsible for conveying the Third World theory and the Green Book to the rising generation, to the young American and British people, so that we can rescue America and Britain and these generations of young people from this theory, which this electoral party theory, which enabled an imbecile like Reagan to rule the mightiest power on earth and use it to destroy other people's homes, and enable the harlot like Thatcher to rule a great nation like Britain.
What?
Harlot Thatcher?
I know, I thought it was shocking.
Pause. That's probably a reasonable place to end it, if you... I'm not
oh,
there.
Yes, yeah, good idea.
Next film is coming up there, but interesting clip. Gaddafi, you know, went on a bit of a tour and went to the UN in 2004. And for all his kind of hyperbolic talking points, interesting clip which I'll post, where he was talking about various issues and rambling and, you know, holding up copies of the Green Book at the delegates. But he chances upon one interesting thing that he says about the swine flu epidemic, which had been taking place at the time. And he says, you know, it was created in a lab and must have leaked from a lab. And of course, the attitude of the delegates is, oh, don't be ridiculous.
I still can't find the kissing meme, so nobody sent it to me. Just a couple of little super chats before we get out of here. G. Davis says, Gaddafi and Maradona parallels.
Hmm.
What parallels are there between? Oh, in terms of trajectory from Chad to like fat lesbian.
Wow.
I always remember there was that weird thing of Maradona posing naked with like the world's smallest penis, and it became like a bit on fantasy football of all things that Badil and Skinner like kept on going back to this shot of Maradona naked, but could be mistaken.
World's smallest penis. I mean, did he have a genuine micro penis?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I probably can't show that on screen. But it became like it was like a thing.
Yeah.
That he was posing, and
gosh.
Yeah, it was a thing. I think he was maybe even still like hadn't quite retired yet as well, but because he was like pretty fat at the end.
Yeah.
Even while he was still playing.
He's in his Marlon Brando period.
Yes.
Bit like me.
Yeah, people are confirming it was fantasy football that kept on bringing that up over and over again. So, okay. Next super chat, also from G. Davis, says, as a 90s teen, I felt a huge shift from the early to mid to late 90s, Woof and Gordon Brittus to OK Computer and Nike teen 90s. Hyper-normalization, but no single pre-Blair event pins it down. Yeah, there's definitely an early to late 90s shift, isn't there? Very different vibe. Early 90s, like kind of Mr. Motivator, kind of
because it's
colourful, kind of
tinged by the 80s, obviously, still. And then you get the real pure 90s, like you're saying, and you move into the OK Computer 90s, which then itself continues into the early 2000s, which feels just like the 90s. Obviously, this is just time. It's kind of bound to happen, isn't it?
Chris Primer says, sorry to bring it back to pro wrestling, but one of the things I love about the world of pro wrestling, Nick, is that it basically, it's always about 10 years behind the actual culture. So it'd be like, you know, I remember it was like 1995. And Vince was like, "Yeah, we need a rap." PN News. Do you remember him? PN. He was like a rapping wrestling guy, or Men on a Mission. That was it. Men on a Mission. But like the form of rap it was like MC Hammer, but in 1995. You know what I mean? So they're always kind of very quite behind.
Wasn't it
like mainstream culture? You know,
William Gibson at the start saying that people live 10 years behind where we actually are. Maybe that's why wrestling's so comforting.
Yeah, conceptually, yeah.
Because it's one of those things I get a kick out. Like, I used to watch like early 80s wrestling, like Vince Sr. era, and guy like The Fink coming out in 1983, but he's still wearing his 1970s frilly shirts and, you know, you can still see people wearing flares, and so the actual culture is quite different from how culture is remembered. You know, there's always a lag, I always think of that Carry On film where they meet the hippies. You know, there's that Carry On film where Sid James is there and the hippies come over the field. Even that was probably outside of time, you know. Brendan Turner says, credit rules all in America. You can't even get certain jobs with bad credit, let alone a small loan for a few hundred dollars or a car or a house.
See?
Chris Primer says, they say if you eat a bottle of ashwagandha and astragalus gummies, you can see the walls melt, man.
Is that ayahuasca he's talking about or something?
Ashwagandha. Ashwagandha. Oh. I don't know what that is.
Okay. Sounds like something Joe Rogan would take.
I've only had one trippy experience. And it was when, I mentioned this on Twitter yesterday, that I got really ill. I was still in school, like around the time I was doing my GCSEs. I got like a cold that I couldn't shake. And I'd had it for ages. And I remember one of the teachers was like to me, you need to go and see the doctor, you know. And so I did, because I'd had this cold that I had for ages and I couldn't shake it. And they put me on amoxicillin. Turns out that I'm a little bit allergic to amoxicillin. But at the same time, I don't know if my dad knew I was on amoxicillin, but he was like, oh, have a tot of whiskey, that'll sort you out. Right. So I had a tot of whiskey while I was on amoxicillin. And I mean, in fact, funny, we mentioned the Prodigy, right? Do you remember the Breathe video where there were those giant insects and things coming out of the sink and crawling up the walls and so on, huge millipedes and things like that? I was seeing stuff like that. I remember my mum gave me like a jacket potato when I could see the germs coming off the end of the jacket potato. So because of this, I couldn't eat anything. I ended up like having to go into hospital, and they brought out a creepy psychiatrist who had like the classic kind of comb over hair and looked like he touched kids. And I just said, like, I have to get out of here. I was like, I'm going, I'm not staying here. So I just kind of left the hospital while I was there.
So you had some hallucinations at some point?
Like, yeah, yeah. I mean, I was literally seeing like giant centipede germs on food. But because of that, I wasn't eating. So I went, like, during this period, I went down to like 7 stone.
Sounds like I've had a bout of Shigella.
Shigella, what's that?
Shigella, it's just a bacterial infection. You can pick it up from food, water, but it does have a characteristic thing of people can get hallucinations, and amoxicillin was commonly used to treat it.
Sounds to me like you've ended up in a David Cronenberg film. Like, yeah. It sounded like a horrible mixture, like some sort of Clockwork Orange mix, some sort of Naked Lunch directed by Cronenberg.
At the time, I was really into Bowie. And at the back of my mind, I was thinking, like, was this what it... Because famously, he went down to a very low weight and was living on milk and chilies and, like, you know, and heroin, basically. I was thinking, like, is this what it's like, you know? But, yeah, anyway, so... That was that. All right. I think that's it for the super chats. The stream's never that big on super chats, but we do it for the love, you know. This show is subsidized by the rest of the channel. Sorry. all right. Nick, where can people find you?
Well, I'm at NJ Dixon on Twitter, which I always forget to say. And there's my YouTube, which is just Nick Dixon. And, of course, nickdixon.net, where all my extra stuff is. And as we were talking, and we talked about David Betts earlier, well, David Betts posted about my Starkey interview, weirdly, saying this is a great interview which explains very much. How about that?
Fantastic.
Yeah, he talks about the Civil War inevitably. But anyway, go on.
Yeah.
Simon?
I'm on Twitter, at Simon_Roberts. And hopefully I'll be doing another stream with Nick on the weekend. Maybe we'll be reviewing something interesting.
Less likely to get copyright swiped.
Yeah. But do like and subscribe to Nick's channel on YouTube. There is his avatar. He's producing great work.
I'll just remind people, do pick up courses at the Academic Agency, Trivium, Foundations of Shakespeare, all the best ones. Research. Maybe I'll just give you a free one, Nick. I'll just give you a free
one. And then I can review it.
Why not? And I will be... I do have a video tomorrow, but I'm off ski. I'm going to wear, and it's become really hot since we've been doing this stream. It's now like hot and humid, and I need to put my fan on. So probably it's good. It's,
I'm loving this. Still another 2 weeks of summer to go at least. Yeah. Summer, go away! Screams AA on Office Hours yesterday.
Sick of it. Absolutely sick of it. All right. Bye, guys. Same.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.